Town Ruley Committee meeting for December 6, 2010 will come to order. Please turn off our silence electronic devices. Mr. Avery, would you just pledge, please?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Call roll, please.
Councilmember Lynn.
Here.
Councilmember Bouders. Councilmember Avery.
Here.
Councilmember Andre.
Here.
Councilmember Kershaw.
Present.
Councilmember Pastor.
Here.
Mayor Norman.
Here. Ms. Bouders sent me an email just a few minutes ago. She's having a re-experience of pain in her neck. She was doing much better until now, but says she'll be back next Monday. She was doing all right. In your package is the meeting minutes for the November meeting. If there's any corrections, we can make them. Next meeting, they'll be on the agenda. For committees, Public Works, as the council is aware, I sent a letter to the vendor for the aerators that we have in the sewer pond and told him to come get them or fix them. The guy actually has some stainless steel pontoons made for it. He did it before the Thanksgiving holidays, and since the Thanksgiving holidays, Wayne and him installed them back in. Seems to be working, but time will tell. You know, usually they leak. They have, when they're giving us trouble, they've leaked over a period of time, so we're just going to wait and see. But his response was good, and he very much wants them to work, so we'll keep monitoring it and see what happens. The next item I have is we put in the budget to install that sidewalk at the corner of at River Road and Main Street to go behind that tree rather than around it with the cooperation of the landowner. That was done. It's now installed. For your information, the town had nothing to do with those little concrete pillars that are put up there and that cone. That's not ours. It's the landowner who put it out there. So he's got to deal with the state. State comes and tells him he can't do that. That's between them. That's inside state right away. So we really don't have anything to do with that. There's something else I had. Oh yeah, we're experiencing intermittent problems with the brand new generator that we have at West Live Oak. We tested a few times and it works, and then it doesn't work. And so the vendor has been out here many times. He's in agreement that it doesn't work, and we're trying to get it to work. The generator works, but it's the switching system and all that. It's too simple to be that complicated. It's something we don't know in the panel, so that they're out here again today, so we'll try to keep you posted on that. But that's something we need to get fixed. That's a brand new generator. It shouldn't give us any trouble. And anybody have anything else planning? Public Works? I was going to talk about that later, but the trees, obviously everybody knows the trees are planted along St. Francis, and the vendor has a one-year warranty that they keep them alive for a year.
We do those bags just periodically.
Yeah, we do. They
based on rain?
Based on rain. Based on his recommendation. Bags. Yeah, the water bags. Yeah. We took them out, picked them up one time, they put them back, and it's a something he just kind of like tells when he needs them. Planning and zoning, we had a meeting on the 23rd, and we're going to have at least three items on the agenda next time, all three of them are subdividing property. There's a fourth item that may be coming up, but they have to get their business in to Ms. Marianne before the... When do you need to buy the stuff?
Wednesday.
By Wednesday. But we know for sure we have three of them on there, so... Take this up at that meeting. Yeah. First thing we've had in like 4 months. All right, main event of the night, TND presentations, Cletus Langlois. This is a little bit of background, small amount of background. Cletus came to my office, I guess, a couple of months ago, can't remember when, and indicated that Harry Laws and Company wishes for the town to consider passing an ordinance for traditional neighborhood developments. To that end, Cletus furnished everyone with a copy of the ordinance that is now in the parish's set of ordinances. I think it came last month, was it?
Yes, sir.
Came last month, and then we kind of set tonight as a night where we'll just have a discussion. As with all committee meetings, it's open to the public as far as comments and all. We're not going to vote on anything tonight, but ask Cletus to provide us with some, with a presentation on what they are and what their plans are, if necessary.
Thank you, Mayor. And what I'd like to do tonight, of course, I have Mr. Butch Foshay here with Harry L. Ellis and Company, and also have Mr. Steve Ube with Architect Southwest. And we're going to let Mr. Steve get up and give you a presentation on T&Ds, smart growth, those type of things, give you a little bit of background. And then the mayor had fronted us with some questions, I think, that may have come from y'all. And so what we do is let's go through the presentation first, and then after that we'll go through the questions, and hopefully we can get all of the answers we need tonight. And so without any further ado, Mr. Steve.
Thank you, Cletus. Just by way of background, I am an architect, and I'm involved in the development of about 45 communities across the Gulf Coast, ranging in Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama. I'm based out of Lafayette. We were commissioned by Harry L. Laws probably 2 years ago to evaluate how they can look at the structuring of development of their land holdings. And obviously, the menu that we have to select from is huge when you're dealing with 4,000 acres of property. It's the question we have is, how do you responsibly do it? Just the way by getting some additional information that might be helpful, I am a Louisianian. I was born and raised in Iberia Parish. I was a sugarcane farmer, still am, or my family is. I grew up in a small town, and I understand the dynamics of small town America. I think that it's something that we all should value and should try and maintain as much as possible. In 1989, I was commissioned by a wealthy oil and gas person in Lafayette to develop a plan for their land holdings, and it was really the desire of the wife to develop 180 acres around the concept of the village that she grew up in, and she called it a subdivision, but the reality was she grew up in Algiers, Louisiana. And her first comment to me was, you know, we're very wealthy now, but I've never been happier than I was growing up in this small town. And I immediately understood it, because I too have grown up in that kind of an environment, and you know, time goes on, you move around, and I experienced the life of a city, and I didn't really appreciate it. And it was interesting, in her view, about what it was that caused the unhappiness. And she said, you know, as a child growing up, this place she grew up in was very special because she knew everyone, everyone knew her. She went to school within a few blocks of her home. She went to church within a few blocks of her home. It was a very comfortable kind of an existence, and when she left it, she really didn't miss it until later she understood the value of that kind of place. And so we began the development of what today is called River Ranch. It was the first traditional neighborhood development in Louisiana. At the time, we assumed it would be a pretty simple thing to do. It was not, I mean, by any stretch of the imagination, all we were doing was creating what many have called nostalgia. We're recreating what was historic. It was very quickly that we realized that when we tried to code the things that made Algiers what Algiers is, was illegal. It had become illegal over about a 50-year window of time. It happened very, very slowly. And when we went to get River Ranch approved, we were confronted with 400 vigilantes who really, we called them vigilantes, they were community citizens who opposed development of any kind, but particularly the kind of concept where the picture in their minds was an assembly of suburbia in a very tight-knit environment, and it didn't work mentally in their minds. We ultimately got it approved. That was 12 years ago. It was not an easy thing to do. Today, River Ranch is one of the most successful new developments in the country. It is one of the most successful traditional neighborhood developments in the country. Now, I'm going to talk specifically to some of your questions because you're asking some very pointed questions, and I hope to be able to address those. But in order to explain the project that we're doing for the Sinclair development, I need to kind of break it down and explain to you the concept of the traditional neighborhood development, if you would allow me to go through this with you. This image you see here is actually the first building we did at River Ranch. It was the sales building. And in reality, it was coded around the code that we wrote. Now, I'm going to provide to you a copy, which is on this desk here, in a minute, which defines how we get the architecture we want. One of the things we have found about suburbia in our studies is that in suburban development, we don't really code architecture. We mandate price value by creating a minimum lot size. And the truth of the matter is lot sizes today in suburbia average, on average, about 100 by 150. What we have found, too, is that the market is not looking for those kinds of lots exclusively. They would like, myself included, a smaller lot. I'm not interested in necessarily maintaining a large property. There are many of us in that boat. There are still many who would prefer a large lot product, which we need to provide. This is a project that we worked on in South Carolina called New Point. It's brand new. It's probably, well, I say it's brand new. It's about 12 years old or 13 years old now. The irony is that what you see here is, in most places, including Brule, illegal to build. And if you begin to dissect what builds this kind of streetscape, it's an interesting dynamic. This street is 18 feet wide. It's set off of sidewalks by a greenway that's 8 feet wide, and the houses are set back 5 feet from the right-of-way. In most jurisdictions in America, this is no longer allowed. You'll also notice that there are no driveways along the street. The irony is that all of the drives and services and utilities occur on the rear of lots, on alleys, that create a streetscape that has been proven to be very, very friendly to children and older people who are not necessarily driving to and from work every day. And we're finding that it's an extremely positive market that we very seldom build in communities. If you drive your streets today, many of your older streets in your neighborhoods are built just like this at a time prior to the advent of all of the engineering that's associated with current subdivisions. And we began to ask questions about that and ask why. I'm going to skip some of this presentation because it gets into a lot of detail, but one of the interesting things about this movement that I'm involved with, called New Urbanism, actually, traditional neighborhood development, is that it focuses on really what has happened to communities over the course of the last 50 years. And as I present this, you'll understand more specifically what I'm going to kind of gesture, at least in the form of ideas that we should be reviewing. We did, many of you probably already know, we did a traditional neighborhood development here 2 years ago called Riverview, and it's right at the foot of the bridge. That project is getting ready to break ground, and it has been sitting because the market share and the economics just haven't been there. One of the first things thrown in our face was nobody's going to move to West Baton Rouge because the traffic is going to be just horrendous. Well, the truth of the matter is we brought in some of the best traffic engineers in the country, and what they determined was that the traffic is not bad coming to West Baton Rouge, and if actually you do a few things, you can address that very easily. Quite frankly, if you drive from East Baton Rouge into the city, if you drive from the east side of Baton Rouge, it takes a lot longer to get into the city. And there's a value that you guys have that I think is marketable. And so traffic is always something that we have to pay attention to. In 2001, National Geographic actually put their finger on the real issue here, and they call it suburban sprawl. We are building at the rate today of a kind of lifestyle that is not going to be absorbable. And in many of the bigger cities in America, you're beginning to see these things really prove out. This is Phoenix, Arizona. Prior to 2008, Phoenix was the fastest growing city in America. In 1940, it was 23,000 people. Today, it's over 5 million people. And it has grown using the suburban model. Today, actually in 2010, it has the highest foreclosure rates in the country, all suburban. And the reason is that it was overbuilt, obviously, but it was built around the single family dynamic of a typical American household. In 1971, 75% of all people grew up in a typical American household, husband, wife, two children. Today, that population is only 23%. Now, in the South, is probably more in the neighborhood of 35% to 40%. We still have a pretty significant family value base. Point, I'm bringing up some of these things so that we can kind of build a timeline about what's happening across the country. Houston, Texas. Houston is obviously a pretty significant city. I remember in Lafayette when I was on the chamber there, we actually had a goal to model ourselves around Houston, you know, kind of where Houston has been. Truth is, now Houston is not that successful. People have actually begun losing the lifestyle that they once appreciated. It's been estimated that by the time a person retires in Houston, having worked there 30 years, they will have spent 3.5 years driving behind the wheel of their automobile, an hour and a half to work, an hour and a half back. Those are things that are the result of suburban sprawl. And so just keep that in mind. Many of our cities are experiencing this problem. We did a timeline. With the lighting in here, it's probably difficult to read, but the timeline essentially explains suburban sprawl and what happened. This timeline starts in 1900, actually 1896, is when zoning started in Europe. In 1923, it was adopted here.
Mary, why don't you turn off the light while we do this part? There's still one more. Just turn it back on when you're ready.
The on the very far is, left is obviously, is there, there was a pointer somewhere.
Yes.
Perfect.
There you go.
The 1890s here was Europe. The Industrial Revolution was when we began separating uses. And we separated industry from living first. That was the kind of the panacea. We realized that if you took industrial uses out of residential areas, people were healthier. And it became kind of the pattern. 1923, the Euclid zoning case in New York, where a developer wanted to begin defining a certain type of house and separation of other houses from it. It was tested at one. Between 1923 and 1947, there were as many as 50 different zoning classifications and the advent of what we call today the Euclidean zoning law, which I would venture to say you have adopted in this community in some form or fashion. What we have discovered in the last 20 years is the Euclidean zoning law is against the grain in the development of great communities. And we're beginning to find that the illnesses that are resulting from that are due specifically to the Euclidean practice. In 1947, right after World War II, we had adopted Euclid in 1923. 20 years later, the soldiers are coming back from World War II. We're beginning to rebuild this country. And keep in mind what happened just prior to World War II. We were going through the Great Depression. We were the inner cities were actually places that were not considered great. When soldiers returned, they were building houses for the first time outside of city centers. They were building it away from the city centers. And you fast forward to the early 60s when all of our downtowns began to die. The reason for that was the services were moving out to where the houses were. And this time, because they were moving independent of how people live day in and day out, they move now based on zoning laws that mandated you could not build housing adjacent to grocery stores, for instance, or churches had to be separate. Schools were separated. It was zoned now separate. And that was all great because cars were an easy thing to deal with. We are now beginning to understand that the car is not necessarily the luxury that we all appreciated it to be years and years ago, and now at the price of gas running up, I'm going to run through some of these, the price of gas running up to $5 a gallon is predicted by the end in two more years, you're going to begin seeing people making different lifestyle choices. The idea of industrial separation started off as a really great idea, but it's gone awry. The idea of being able to resolve a lot of our issues using automobiles and fuel is beginning to be retested, and the great American dream of being able to resolve all of our problems by using the automobile has to be questioned. In Europe, we're now referred to as the auto nation because every decision we make, whether we realize it or not, is based on the use of the automobile. And I'll show you some examples of that in a second. These are slides that actually talk about the ills of development around the suburban strategy. This is a community that was built in 1871. If you look at it, it's a beautiful place, and you can say it's beautiful because it's historic, but the truth of the matter is this place functioned extremely well. It has a mix of uses. You have a school, you have a church, you have businesses, you have houses. all within what has been determined to be a walking a community or walkable zone. It's been determined that that's about a 1,300 linear foot walk zone, and I'll show you some diagrams. The idea of the interstate highway introduced by Dwight Eisenhower after World War II was not intended as an inner city thoroughfare pattern. It was intended to move people from city to city in case of war. We failed to realize the impact of that, and what has happened to the interstate system is beginning to be developed around the ability of big box stores to come into communities and essentially redefine communities around what the big box is all about, and we're losing the character of community. The idea of towns are still actually very, very positive. We find that when we create things like this, they create huge value, and I can prove that based on our most recent work. The good news is that developers are beginning to understand it, and they see that there is a profit associated with it, and they're now beginning to look at it as a positive venture. This is a cartoon that we developed to kind of define the difference, and you actually have this now in your community. This is a suburban development. It's how it's done. The backbone of the suburban project is that streets have now become a mandate now to be at least 28 feet wide in most cities. In many of the cities we work, this street section is 35 feet. It's also characterized by a disconnected system of streets. If this cul-de-sac connected here, it would be a lot easier for this resident to be able to get around the neighborhood. There's one way in and one way out. That is considered at the time of this development to be the kind of model that creates privacy, creates interest, and at one point created value, particularly if you lived on what the cul-de-sac represented, which was the park. The problem is that because of this dead-end situation, the roads now have to be wider to accommodate emergency vehicles. And as a result, the roads are so wide now that a 35-foot wide street psychologically allows traffic to move at an average speed of 55 miles an hour if you didn't put a speed limit sign up or speed bumps or things of that nature. That is not what people consider walkable. There is value in walkable communities. It's becoming more valuable as we move forward. This is a statistic that you really need to be aware of, whether you side with me on the idea of T&D or not. Today, roughly half of this country, 50% of the 3 million population, falls in two categories. The empty nester, those people born around 1947 to 1964. 78 million of those people exist today, and they controlled the real estate market since they entered the market in 1947. You can follow the patterns. Schools were built in the 50s. High schools, elementary schools, high schools were built in the late 50s, early 60s. Apartments followed suit. Hospitals are now following suit. What's the hot market now? Assisted living. That population is moving in to that demographic. Now, what's making it very interesting is the young buyer, people who are now in their early 20s, we call them millennials. They're entering the market on the other side. They want the exact same thing as the baby boomer, which is a very interesting dynamic. They want residential, but they do not want the big lot that many of us wanted. They do not want, nor do they, will they pay for the big house. They instead would require or actually appreciate what we've come to learn as a quality factor as opposed to a quantity factor. Higher quality, smaller price, or smaller size. So when we began looking at the old community or the suburban development model, we began to understand that this maybe isn't the only way to do it. You know, if I live at this house here, if I want to visit someone here, I end up driving. It creates traffic, it creates congestion, it's an environmental issue. It also precludes me from being able to walk, which is another side note. People who live in towns that have walkable neighborhoods has been proven way less than people who live in suburbia. We walk more. The idea that the grocery store that can occur within the neighborhood because zoning doesn't allow it to is now on the arterial, which requires auto traffic travel. The T&D, on the other hand, the traditional neighborhood development, is nothing more than taking all these ingredients and restructuring it in such a way that, again, introduces the grid, which allows for streets to be smaller, less expenditure by councils, by cities, by developers in building bigger streets, because obviously there are ways to get around. There still are arterials that collect all of this. There are still collectors. They're just set up in a different methodology. The idea that people can walk to parks, they can walk to grocery stores, they can walk to schools, because the grid allows that to occur, is a very significant concept. It also creates huge value to the community. One of the things that we've been told was that, you know, suburbia is actually very attractive. We're not arguing about that. It's not about attractiveness. It's about the ability to create something that is more environmentally sensitive, something that is more sustainable by the city, and I'll talk about those in brief part here. The idea that we end up solving the problems of suburbia through significant infrastructure projects, this is called a continuing flow intersection. We built one of these on Sherwood Forest Boulevard in Baton Rouge. We're building one in Lafayette now. This is a $13 million expenditure. It is required because there is no grid within this neighborhood. In order to get traffic to move, they build these significant expenditures. This is our community in Lafayette. I mean, it's suburbia to the hill. This is Johnston Street. This is Ambassador Caffrey. The Acadiana Mall is located here. It's very interesting that all of the residential that surrounds all of this is suburban in its design, all dead-end streets, one way in, one way out. We're getting ready to widen this to 7 lanes because it does not accommodate the traffic today. The irony is that we could use this money to do a lot of other things in our community, but this is a mandate now because of the model of growth that we subscribe to. Look at this parking lot, if you will. This is the model of Acadiana, July 4th of this particular year. You know, we all know the truth now that parking lots are built for the 3 weeks of Christmas, and it's a huge draw on communities. Now, you drive down Johnston Street today, and this is not considered Santa Monica Boulevard. It's pretty much a suburban sprawl roadway. We're now getting ready to spend over $1 million on this sector, which is a mile and a half, to convert it to a walkable street. The worst part of it at all is that we're still building this kind of new thoroughfare in our community, and we're beginning to now acknowledge that it's the wrong way to go. What I did was I tried to create a drawing to show what might be different if we had another choice. Here's Johnston Street again. Here's the big parking lots and the big box guys who, Walmart, for instance, who come into our community and build a Walmart that looks like any Walmart in the country. It doesn't have anything to say about Acadiana or South Louisiana. And in reality, it's not a very beautiful place. When we bring people into our city, we don't really try and promote them by bringing them down this kind of thing, which is a commentary. What we said was, what about if we just move the parts around a bit? Here's the same Johnston Street. We call this a street. We call this an avenue. It's tree-lined. It softens the edge. We move the buildings to the street's edge. We design the buildings around an architecture that's about South Louisiana. And we dedicate the parking to another zone that's not about this corridor. Residential is connected into it so that you do have access, and you preclude people going through the neighborhood by designing the neighborhood properly so that people really are not interested in driving through it because the streets aren't comfortable for their use. This is a concept set of photographs that we developed to show, if you will, if you vision this as LA1 right outside, here's your concept. Here's the four lanes and the service road that occurs on the side and your power poles and the disjointed architecture that really is out of scale. What we said was, how about if we first start thinking at least about, let's let people walk if they can. And we start introducing sidewalks and landscaping that makes some sense with lighting that's pedestrian friendly, and maybe a trail that they can follow. Allow some parking to occur. Download the big parking lot and put some parking on the street. That's a novel idea that was done really successfully. And then start introducing an architecture code that builds buildings that are to scale with this huge corridor that you have. And over time, what will happen is it will start building in. It's not going to happen overnight. It takes time to do this kind of stuff. And when you begin seeing this kind of success, there's actually huge economic value in creating efficiencies of vertical stacking. Parking is occurring behind the building and on the street in the foreground. It becomes a much more appealing kind of an environment. Now, this can be suburbia here. I mean, this is not a whole lot of different kind of uses, the commercial component. In this case, we might allow a living piece to occur on the second floor. The introduction of landscaping is not simply about beautification. It's also about creating a scale that people feel comfortable living within, whether it's automobile-related or whether it's pedestrian-related. The concept of being able to create an environment that creates beauty. I mean, why would we not do this? Because suburbia creates a number of issues when we begin talking about these kinds of things. We're scared to introduce it. This is the kind of environment, again, think of where I started with this elevation, and in a short period of time, this can happen. We're doing this. This is doable, and it's not costing communities anything. The truth of the matter is, at River Ranch, if you were to look at the numbers, in 1998, the ad valorem taxes generated on a 300-acre tract of property was about $700 annually. Today, that exceeds $3 million in a place that people will pay huge dollars to live in. And it begins to attract a population of both young and old, which we believe is the future of, hopefully, Louisiana. And long-term, we have to be thinking outside of the box. I think at $5 a gallon, transit becomes a viable option on major corridors. I'll back up. This slide is commercial. You can do the same thing with residential uses. This is a residential concept. Now, many of us might look at this slide and say, yeah, okay, fine, that's a great idea, but it can't happen here. Well, I don't know why. It's happening now in all places in this country. We're losing our young people at a phenomenal rate. Why? Because they find these kinds of things appealing, and they're finding it elsewhere. We are proposing the idea of a traditional neighborhood development in this area. The idea is really nothing more than creating something out of typical infrastructure. You know, we have a great example of it in Louisiana. This is the French Quarter. When we did our first charrette at River Ranch, I remember bringing this slide up and saying, it's interesting to know that at that time, they were generating $2 billion a year in tourism dollars in this French Quarter. This was built in the 1700s when people built around how they lived, not how they were governed to live. This is a public square. It's exactly 1 acre. A cathedral, a museum, retail, offices, residential, sells over $1,000 a square foot on 20-foot wide streets with a grid that moved 25 to 30,000 cars a day at 15 to 20 miles an hour. By all stretches of the imagination, on a suburban basis, this is a huge failure. People drive, fly into the New Orleans airport and pass up 17 miles of suburban sprawl to experience this. Yet we're still building suburbia. This is what people envision when I talk about the corner store. Why can't we provide a corner store in our neighborhoods where people can walk to get a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk? You can't do it in suburbia because it's zoned out. Well, the truth of the matter is, this is a suburban infraction. It's all about the convenience of the car, drive in, drive out. This is not about an architecture of place. It's about a 7-Eleven that can be built in any place in America that looks just like this. We have them in every city. The real estate value on each side of this development is zero. These two parcels of property have been on the market as long as this has been built. It is a suburban concept. What we proposed from the very beginning in River Ranch was a corner store. This is the corner store. It is exactly the same size per square foot. Sales are the same. The difference is it's an architecture that fits within the place that we're building in. It has a secondary use above it. In this case, the original owner of this building lived here. This is an apartment building. It rents for about $1,000 a month. It's 600 square feet. This is how it was done in the 1800s. This is New Hampshire, the corner store. A townhouse, a single-family residence, all in line. The end of this block has a home that sells for over $1 million. The uses are compatible. What defines this is an architecture that is compatible to one another, that is built within the community to model around the community and creates itself as a living kind of a community model. I talked to you a minute ago about the five-minute walk zone. This is River Ranch, 300 acres. This is our town square. This circle represents 5 minutes. I live right here. I walk to the gym every morning. There's a health club here. There's five restaurants in this corner. There's a clinic here. There's offices. There's cleaners. There's everything I need to do what I need in this community. When we built it, it was illegal. There were 119 variances to get it approved. Today, it is considered one of the most successful in the country. It was just recognized by Urban Land Institute as one of the top five communities in America. That's the kind of thing we can create. Now, it's not an easy thing to do. Obviously, there are a lot of rules. I'm not going to get into this particular component. I want to actually get into the proposal that we have for Sinclair. So if you could please bear with me. Now, what we structured for the Sinclair project is a phased approach to developing a community. In suburbia, what's interesting about suburbia, in order to make suburbia work, in order to do a subdivision in suburbia, you essentially have to build the entire thing because it is disconnected typically, and it's a very difficult thing to make work financially unless you do it. When we came into the West Bank or the West Baton Rouge to discuss how we were going to approach this, one of the most significant things that we will do is to try and acknowledge the place that we're in. This is our site. You're all familiar with this oak tree, actually. The elementary school is located in the foreground right here. The idea is that we take the environment and work with it. Where there are open ditches today, we'll probably use as detention and retention for our development because it was placed here for a reason. It happens to be, in this particular case, the collector at the center of our property that brings water back to the wetland to the west. The idea of where roadways exist, the idea that we can utilize some of these as corridors for our future development, is important to us. The idea that there's a school, which, by the way, the land was donated by the Harry L. Laws Corporation. We believe that schools are the most significant component of community. We believe that in order to create the kind of value system that communities are all about is hinged upon the success of schools. You happen to have a very successful school system here. And so we want to capitalize on that. We want to continue building that school system to make it even better. But we want the community to be able to barter based upon its value. These are some interesting facts. To survive, a strip shopping center of 200,000 square feet needs 20,000 drive-by trips per day. 13 million Americans are now running their own businesses from home. Now, this is a statistic that nobody really understands. What impact has that had on the kind of subdivisions we develop? I think you're going to find these statistics changing significantly when the price of oil continues to escalate to a point where people begin working more and more out of their houses. 1.7 million earn more than $100,000, and 37% are women. Today's buyer, by the way, is 9% male, single male, 22% single female. We're beginning to design neighborhoods not for the typical American household that we can conveniently assume is a husband, wife, and two kids and a dog. It's much different, and we need to be thinking about that. Neighborhoods that are designed with mixed use are safer. Busing students, $400 per student per year. If we can have neighborhood schools where kids can walk to school, it saves the community significant dollars. From 1985 to 1993, the average lot in the state of Maryland increased 35% in size. If they had remained the same size, 30,000 acres of open countryside would have been spared development. When we were working on the recovery effort for Louisiana right after Hurricane Katrina, we were assigned Abbeville. And we did an aerial fly through of the region, and we acknowledged that over 10,000 acres in the course of the previous 12 years had been consumed by suburban sprawl, by developing one road in with houses on both sides that had no connectivity and no future value to the community. We rewrote the codes, and today the city and region of Vermilion Parish is growing around all of these things. I'll kind of skip through some of these things because they become a little bit mundane. We conducted a charrette about 2 months ago. The charrette essentially was a workshop that tried to discuss options, and we met with citizens, we met with a number of, we met with your mayor. I think we were trying to get ideas and understand the feedback that we needed to get to be sensitive to really what the region was. We developed a series of about 8 or 9 different schemes. We took the best ideas of each, and then we created one concept. This drawing that you see up here, I actually have a hard board of, and we can show you that later. It actually looks at all of the proposed development that Harry L. Laws can consider over the course of the next, truth of the matter is, probably 100 years. But what it does is it begins to frame the responsible growth patterns that I think we need to be all looking at. We were made aware that there are problems with access coming from the west side of the track trying to get onto LA1. Today, that neighborhood only has really one way in and one way out. We're proposing a grid system that connects all the way back, and we've met with Bubba Phillips to talk to him about the idea of another lateral that parallels LA1 all the way back to the Intracoastal Waterway and back to connect, hopefully in the future, to a proposed bridge that gets us to the Lobdell exit. I mean, those are the kinds of things that I think this kind of planning begins to focus our attention on. The site studies that we came up with essentially will parallel this concept. Just by way of orientation, here's the elementary school. The ball fields are located here. The new subdivision that was built recently, Brule Oaks, is here. The idea that South LeBove Road, again, existing open ditch, runs across here. When you look at the drawing later, the board that I have, we're proposing that LeBove actually run due north through our property to connect to a future potential neighborhood located in this direction here. The land that we own is outlined in red here on the west side and in red here on the east side. This is the entire concept or the entire land holding of the Harry L. Laws Corporation here in the Brule area. We're located here. The idea is that while we're trying to be sensitive, this is all wetland. We want to propose that this be retained as wetland, but it become a future resource to the region as a natural preserve, and we're actually dedicating that as a preserve. We're also proposing in this area the future development of real estate. Again, when we don't have a clue when the market will be positioned for that. But in each of these plays, we have a neighborhood here, we have a neighborhood here, we have a neighborhood here, we have a neighborhood here. The idea of neighborhood is that it's walkable. It's that there are mixed uses with differing densities of smaller lots to very big lots, 10 acres. In this particular neighborhood, we're actually proposing an equestrian center where riding trails can actually go through wetland that exists here and all the way back up into here. We're not proposing any golf courses. We're proposing things that are, we believe, environmentally sustainable. This is the existing vegetation, easements that occur through the property, where the wetlands occur, and then the concept sketches that we propose for the first neighborhood of additions. Here's the school that you can begin seeing kind of the lay of the land. There's a natural drainage escarpment that runs here, so all of these schemes follow that and use that. We're gesturing ponds here. Those are detention. We know that you're having a flooding problem here now in your more recent suburban development. What we're proposing in all of our neighborhoods is that we will retain at 120%, not 100%. We're going 20% beyond. We're going to retain 20% more runoff than you are currently retaining or dealing with on this property. Today, it's fields. The water runs off at a pretty slow rate. We're proposing that it run off 20% slower because we're going to retain it and create amenities on that property. The schemes that we developed were finalized into what you see here, and this is the proposal that Cletus showed you earlier. In order to make sure that we create value in a community like this, we can't simply do what is customarily done, and that is a two-dimensional site plan. This is the concept plan, but it is accompanied by what we call the guiding principles, which is about a 300-page code, which I have on the desk in front of you. And that code defines the urban requirements, which says what size all these lots are based on market absorption. But it also goes three-dimensional and talks about where buildings will be placed, the kinds of streets that are built, the architecture that's going to be built here, and those all will be converted into governances that you will actually formally adopt. Just a blow-up plan of that same kind of a view, just to kind of give you a feel for what we're thinking of here. The elementary school is within 5 minutes of this furthest lot. Our first neighborhood says to the market that if you have a child who lives here and it goes to that school, they can actually walk. Now, we're going to have to do some improvements to be able to do that. We're going to have crossings that are going to have to be dealt with. But those are the kinds of value systems that I think we can introduce. This is actually an alley. If you look at this, every one of these lots is loaded with alleys. So that, you know, there's been some discussion about the size of lots, and somebody said, wow, 40 feet, you got to be kidding me. A 40-foot lot is equivalent to a suburban 60-foot lot. Why? Because you don't have the driveway on the front. On all of these houses, you will have seamless sidewalks that run the entire distance for people to walk. So it's an attraction for both old and young. We're also proposing another civic use here. We met with the library group. We're proposing that there be a library built here, and we're going to donate that property to the library. Our proposal also suggests that the school and the library joint venture so that there's some cross uses occurring. Our proposal also suggests that the school today may need to be expanded upon, that that expansion occur on this edge adjacent to this roadway that we're building, so that now you have a more urban kind of concept where bus drop-off can occur, where the expansion can occur, and actually the land is available to do that. This is a scheme, a rendering actually, looking at the frontage ditch. This is the ditch that occurs. We want to beautify that. We're not trying to cover it. We're not trying to change it because the cost is exorbitant. Here are the cottages in front. The school is actually right here. This is the town center. Here's that oak tree that exists on the site. This is our village neighborhood center where there can be a corner store here, and there can be offices for service companies located above. The idea, if I'm standing at the school looking back toward that same intersection, here are the cottages, and here is our village center, neighborhood center. There's a town square here. The library would actually be positioned right here. Here's the oak. Looking at the village center again, here's the library with a kind of a civic engagement piece here. The possible expansion of the elementary school would be a gestured concept here, anchoring the termination of that roadway coming in off Lebove. Here's the town square. The ability of the library to engage kids where there's an amphitheater. This is a main street, if you will. On-street parking, the main street running around. Most of the parking for these buildings is associated with rear parking, with passages that will allow people access to these buildings. The character of the retention. Here's our detention ponds. If you notice, there's some freeboard here. This is what happens when excessive rains and water comes all the way up to here. So that's the detention component, that's the concept. We actually front houses onto this. We're not fencing these, we're creating a public amenity. These will become public, maintained through the association. Here's an aerial view of that. Again, here's the school, the ball fields, the idea of the village center, and then the residential occurring here. The closer you get to the village center, the smaller the lots are. These are 40-foot by 100-foot cottage lots. The further you get, the bigger they get, just like it occurred in this community over many, many years. The edge lots are large lots. As we get further from the town center, the less walkable it will become. We'll have acreage lots where you can buy, if you want, large lots. That's the kind of product we'll make available. Here's the expansion of the school. Now, all these are just pretty pictures until we begin to talk about how we make it law. This is a set of documents that we call the urban regulations, and essentially addresses every lot type from commercial to live work, which is the village center building. I said retail and office above. We have the potential to have rentals. In this particular project, we don't have those. In future neighborhoods, particularly in the larger product down the road, we will. Townhouses are products that we don't have coded, as you can see here. They're not existing in the current scheme of things. Cottage lots all the way up to neighborhood and mansion homes. This tells you the setbacks, the frontage setback, You know, in suburbia, you have a 20 to 25-foot front yard requirement. The reality is that was put there to allow the car to park in the front yard without encroaching public right-of-way. When you take the car out of the front yard, you can slide the house forward. When the house slides forward, front porches now have functional interface with sidewalk use, and you begin to get people who know one another in neighborhoods. We break the regulations down into parking, into how the elevations are to be delineated. We get into to parking or the corner lot, how it fits on a corner, whether there will be porches, et cetera, et cetera. All of those are defined. That instruction sheet I just showed you is a complement to the regulating plan. This particular note will tell you what your lot specification is, and you can find it on that drawing. Here's a graphic explaining the instructions. So we're now saying these are all of our requirements. Here it is drawn, and this is how it works. Just so you can kind of get a sense, our buildings are coded to be two stories in this particular project. We're coding a front porch, a gallery, so that when stores are built, they're connected. This is in the village center. Parking is at the rear. Here's the red parking. Here's the building footprint. Residential, here's the alley, here's the garage, here's the house, mandated front porch. The setback is in the regulations. Further from the town center or village center you get, the further back the house gets, because the less walkable it is. Here's the market study. It actually specifies every lot, every size, and every architectural type. This is just a diagram for the zoning use. This is all the common land. This is private land. The 5-minute walk zone that I talked to you about earlier, you put a dot right here. It's 5 minutes to walk from here to here, 1,320 feet. People who are in their mid-50s, 60s, actually consider this a comfortable walk zone. When you get beyond that, people tend to drive more often. The further you get from the town center, the more often you're going to drive. So in other words, if there's no retail component here, people will drive here just about 100% of the time. And that creates problems. This is a 10-minute walk zone. Children will walk 10 minutes. So you can begin to see, once we begin developing this, the value of the school becomes significant for people who can walk to the school. We have coded sidewalks on every street, both sides. We've designed every street to include its width, its parking. Here's the street legend. This is a public kind of a main street. These are residential streets that control traffic flow, slow traffic down. This is the traffic flow map. It talks about really, this is the perimeter collector, and this is the internal, we call these neighborhood streets that are essentially more about walking and traffic, not just traffic. And then we cut a section through every one of these streets. And these are those sections. So here's the main street. We show formalized parking on each side. We show street trees. We show the building placement, the setback. These actually define the speed limit, the curb type, the drainage type. And we did that for every street in the neighborhood. And this is those diagrams. And then we get into the architectural typology. I mentioned to you earlier, you know, in suburbia, the way you control quality is you control size. Large lots essentially have been equated to at least saying that if you can afford to buy a lot that's this big, you are at a certain financial threshold, you're not going to deplete the value of the neighborhood. That's suburbia. What we do in a traditional neighborhood is in order to compensate for smaller lots is we code the architecture. And when we talk about smaller lots, we have townhouses, we have cottages, and we have different types of styles. We have Acadian architecture. This is based upon what you're currently building. You have Creole architecture, you have colonial classical, and you have the colonial farmhouse. So here they are, in the cottage form, in the village house form, and in the neighborhood house form. If we get into the larger house types, we have manors, and we have, actually, we call these village houses. But again, stylistically, you can build anywhere from townhouses in the Acadian style, all the way up to mansions. When you assemble them on a street, they begin to work one to the other. Now, what I did here is mix different styles, but you can begin now seeing that they all work. Now, what do they have in common? They have front porches. They're elevated above the sidewalk so that when I'm seated on this front porch, I'm not intimidated by people on sidewalks. I am above them, and that's how porches worked. When you get bigger, you can begin seeing how big houses relate. The setbacks get a little bit bigger. The front setbacks get further back. Again, bigger houses, same synopsis. The idea that we're trying to take a piece of property today that has little value relative to you as a tax base is something that we're trying to change. This is a project that we used as a model. It's located outside of Atlanta, Georgia, called Serenby. It is based upon the rural concept of village. You know, you can have urban villages and you can have rural villages. This is what we envision for the Additions neighborhood. This is at the village center. The density in here, in this particular neighborhood, has 8 units to the acre in the village center, one half on the village edge for a net density of 4 units to the acre. But goes to show how you can begin to delineate those kinds of finishes too as well. This is sidewalks. This happens to be, in this particular neighborhood or village, they have a huge preserve, which I referenced earlier. We were going to use our wetlands to create. Here they grow their own herbs and vegetables for the village restaurants, which is a big health market for the Atlanta area. So with that said, I'd like to maybe try and address some of the questions that you have posed to us, unless you have something else you would like to ask at this point.
Why don't you turn the lights on? Well, yeah, we can do that. We have them up there. The questions that we sent to y'all, I grouped them kind of like in different groups. So the first group is, what percentage by area of the original development would be inside the town through the limits, and what portion would be outside? If only part of the T&D would be within the town limits, what method of sewage treatment would be provided for parts outside of town? Is that expectation of annexation of the portion outside the town limits either prior to or after development? So I guess what we're really trying to figure out, and I think, you know, you might want to.
Yeah, these are actually great questions. Well, we do have answers.
That, but it's ones we need answers to.
Okay.
Mayor, on this part, if you look at phase one, which was the way he showed you a while ago, it's going to be 9% is going to be inside the city limits, and 91% will be outside.
Okay.
Now, over the overall part, that percentage of inside the city limits is going to go down to about 5.
5% inside.
In the first phase, it's going to be 9% in the city limits.
To answer your sewer question, you know, first off, I think it's important that we make a comment. Anytime we develop a neighborhood, in this case, a traditional neighborhood, we always believe it is more responsible to become an annexed component of the community as opposed to be a self-state. We're doing this exactly right now.
Yeah.
And so while, you know, obviously we can do a freestanding piece outside of this community, it doesn't really make sense. We want to be part of the neighborhood, or part of the community.
So the real answer is eventually 100%.
Yes. That would be our goal.
All right. And annexation, that answers itself if eventually
you'd like to stay. That's correct.
All right. Let's go to the next page. Oh, wait, does any council member, anybody in the audience have a question about any of those right in there? Anybody?
Did the second one get answered?
I didn't, no.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, what he said was they obviously want the sewage to be part of the town, and therefore it'll be...
We are prepared to build our own. If
you
the community opted out for us, we are prepared to build our own. We have the land available. We can do all of these things.
All
Can you give us, you may answer it later, can you give us an idea of the population growth we're talking about here? I have no concept of.
That's a great question, because to begin with, I think that the net density, when you look at a neighborhood like this, the suburban density of, for instance, Dooley Oaks, I haven't done an analysis on that, but I would suggest probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 units to the acre. It should give you a feeling of suburban deal. At build-out, when we're 100% complete, I would propose that we will be in the neighborhood of 4.5 to 5 units to the acre at build-out. Initially, it may be higher, it may be 6 or 7 units to the acre, because most of it's smaller cottage lots. As we get bigger, the lots get bigger and the density goes down. At build-out, I would think River Ranch, to give you a direct answer, today is 6 units to the acre. We have, in River Ranch, 324 acres, we have 2,100 people living there, in that little enclave. In a suburban context, you'd have 800.
So, in the one you're proposing for us, what would that, do the
well,
math
you know,
for us
how many
and figure
acres
how many people are you talking
about? No, I mean total.
Oh, total, the whole piece on that point is 263.
So you're talking about 1,300 people at build-out.
Oh, okay.
In that range.
All right, good question. All right, next trade. What will be the housing mix? How many lots intended for each, use of each, the size of each? You provide percentages, 20% commercial, whatever percentage is commercial.
Yeah, that's good too.
How many duplexes, townhouses? In other words, just what is it, you know, what are we talking about? What kind of places are we?
I'm going to take the opportunity to begin passing this around. This is the code. And just to show you the level of thought that was given during the charrette, this is what you're asking for, lot sizes, and I'll go through that right now. We have live-work, which is a model, actually, the building code acknowledges it now as a building type, where there are going to be 24, there are potentially 24 second-story components that can be. Now, one of the things about a traditional neighborhood development, and I have to explain it because it's not unusual to understand this, but in a community, like if you go to Plaquemine right now, you know, the second story of all those buildings, the historic use of those things probably was residential. Then it became offices, and then it became residential again. And the bottom might have become residential and offices of bank. The beauty of old towns was that architecture was not built for one use, it was built for a multiple set of uses so that you could continually recycle buildings. The live work is designed to do that. So today when we say live work, the upper story of those buildings can be 24 units. What are they? We don't know yet. They could be offices, they could be rental, or they could be a second floor of the first floor use. We just don't know right now. The building type, and we define that in the code so you can see that, will allow a multiplicity of things to occur. We have 25 cottages, or 26 cottages. We have 61 cottage houses. A cottage is a 36-foot wide lot, a cottage house is a 40-foot wide lot. Village house, 39. Neighborhood house, 25. For a total of 125 units.
Okay, what is a village house?
A village house is, this nomenclature actually relates back to the market study. The market study has indicated that there's a certain buyer who wants a house that is in the neighborhood of 2,800 square feet. That's a village house. So that's where that falls.
2,800?
2,800. It can be anywhere from 23 to 2,800.
So what's a neighborhood house?
A neighborhood house, well, I'm sorry, that was neighborhood house. Village house, let me do this so that we can stay all on the same page. On the market study, I'm sorry, go to the regulations. It's all defined. Here's your lot sizes. The market studies indicate that most of the buyers in these categories are going to be young or baby boomer. And so consequently, those sizes will range in size from a townhouse, which could be as small as 1,200 square feet, to neighborhood houses that could be an average of 2,600 up to 2,800. That's the market. Now, that doesn't say they can't build bigger housing. They can if they want to. We're just saying that what the market study is saying they want.
Next one says, how many duplexes, townhouses, multifamily dwellings, condominiums, and apartments?
Yeah, a duplex is considered a suburban term. We don't even have them. We're not coding them. Townhouses, we actually have 24 live works. We're proposing, they're not shown right here, but we're proposing 7 townhouses at this point. It's not shown here. We're not proposing multifamily as a multifamily development. The live work, however, could have a rental above the store. And there would be 21 of those, or 24 of those, or could be. The reason why we're not proposing multifamily is we don't think that the market will absorb this on this project.
The live work that you keep saying, and again, remember, you're a TND guy.
Yeah, I really appreciate that.
Speak about all these other people. But when you say live work, would the person that is working down there, is that the one who's living above it? Or that could be somebody else?
It could be someone else.
Okay, so it could be rented out to anybody.
That's correct.
You could have a store at the bottom, and you could own the store and rent out the top, somebody else to live in.
Yes, that's correct. Typically what happens, and this model varies from town to town, but typically what happens is initially, and the model is that a person will build an office downstairs and rent the second story as a rental. They do not occupy it. Historically, that was not the case. What they did was they lived above the store, right?
Right.
That's not the norm. But the reality is that because it's a single owner property, it's very well managed. That's the benefit of it. Obviously, you're not, you know, an absentee owner. You are on site. You typically have the office or the restaurant or the retail piece with a rental above. That's the norm. At River Ranch today, and in tradition in Mississippi, the two projects that are most developed, in both cases, those rentals are about 60% higher than a typical apartment rental for the same square footage because of the relationship to the town square and all those amenities that go along. So that's a key component.
How about bed and breakfast establishments?
We have none proposed. It'd be great to actually have an inn, but we don't have that proposed. This particular project, the first phase, would not be supportive of an inn in its beginning.
No. How about special needs housing units?
No, we don't have that.
This is all phase one.
I'm not sure what special needs housing
is. The initial portion.
Well, it's in here. I took it out of here, so I really don't know either.
Okay.
Next page.
All right.
Will all the buildings be built then sold, or will the lots be sold for the owner to build? And will there be any owner-occupied requirement in any residential lot?
That's a good guy. Really, it depends what your market is. I don't know right now whether your market is a speculative market. I don't suspect it's that strong as a speculative market. I mean, it's going to be both, to answer your question.
Well, let me give you the root of that question. Every development that we've had that I know of lately, the developer develops the property and sells the lots. And I don't know anybody who builds them, who's kept all the lots to himself and just built the houses as he went along.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
So I'm just asking if this is the same pattern. Like, you're going to have the
thing
laid out, and the lots will all be out there with signs in the front yard, and you buy your lot, and that's it.
It's going to be a combination. I mean, I think what you're going to find is you'll be selling lots to an individual to build their house. A builder may come in and buy four or five lots and build housing. Right now, what we're finding in today's world is that it's much more the former, not the latter. 3 years ago, builders were buying 5, 6, up to 10 lots and building. We're not seeing that right now. Our goal is always to try and build quickly so that you create place. You don't create place. What creates value in these neighborhoods is being able to walk through the street and feeling the scale and feeling the mix and feeling the life. If you don't have it, you're not really doing much more than a suburban development.
And Mayor, Harry, our laws will restrict the builders also. There'll be an approval list to go through whether they're building a house or purchasing a house to build a lot to build a house. It will be a restriction.
We typically create what we call a builder's guild. There's criteria that is associated with what that guild member has to have, and normally it includes a 5-year background check into buildings that they've done, what has been the experience of the buyer, the quality level. In order to achieve the kinds of quality that we're going to be coded right now in this book, does not allow for contractors who really aren't of that level. And so we, you know, that is going to be a criteria we have. Now that, I'm going to tell you now, that's not something that will be a governed thing by you. Everything else I'm talking about from the standpoint of the land, setbacks, quality of architecture, those are all things you can say we're approving it if you approve it based on that. You know, following through with the Builders Guild, I will tell you, is kind of a slippery slope. You know, so I don't want to set you up and you believe, wow, we're going to have all these great builders here. You're only going to have what you got. And if they're great, good. If they're not, we got to deal with that some kind of way. And you just need to understand that. It's important.
Okay. I got to ask you, I don't quite understand what you're saying there.
Okay.
Because I'm only one of five votes, but I want to make sure I understand what my responsibility is.
And I want you to understand.
So you're saying we could, whatever we decided to approve, we could say this is what we want as our ordinance.
Yes.
And then you said River Ranch had 118 variations or
whatever. Well, yeah, let me explain that to you so you'll understand that whole deal. But I guess maybe let me backtrack a little bit. When River Ranch was proposed, there was no traditional neighborhood development in Louisiana. There were only 20 in the country at the time. So when we came up to get it proposed and approved, there was a lot of confusion. You know, there was nothing to go visit. There was no rules written. There were nothing that the community could rely on. Right now in this parish, your parish has adopted a traditional neighborhood development overlay ordinance. So it's available. It's never been available. You're one of probably a dozen in the state. Okay. So you actually have an ordinance that you can adopt, which essentially mandates what I'm saying in that book right there as a baseline. Now, on top of that, we're including, that ordinance does not include the style of architecture, the quality of architecture. That's our imposition. You can say, we want you to do this, and that's a condition of our approval. That would be a step up. Okay?
You could do that.
Huh?
You're saying we could do
that. You can definitely do that.
Okay.
I
misunderstood. I thought you were really saying we were hamstrung on once we pass this, if a guy wants to put a wigwam up on his lot, he can do it.
No.
Because
no.
It's not our, we can't say anything about architecture.
You can't. You can govern that.
But you only govern 5%.
We only allow 5 wigwams in the entire government.
Unless we,
annex
a larger portion of property. What you're going on is going to be governing a total of 5% of this development. The parish will be governing the other 95%. Based on this book, adopted.
As it
so it's not going to be anything less than what's in this book.
That's correct.
You just can only upgrade 5% of the development, if I'm hearing right.
At this time.
Will be governed by that book, but 5% of it you have sale.
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, well, if we get to something that's really the meat of a lot of the concerns. Okay, when you say that we can say with things, you know, once it's adopted, we have a say-so. I saw you flashed up there certain types of architecture and all that stuff with a, you know, what it looked like.
Right.
You develop the thing and a guy comes along and he buys a lot. It's his lot. He owns the lot. And he says, you know, to build it to one of these things is just too expensive and I don't like the design, whatever.
Right.
I just don't like it. And I refuse to do that. I'm building my own house there, whatever way I want to build it. Now, who and how is that person stopped from doing that? Is that a civil matter within the TND, or is it a government matter?
That's a civil matter.
Okay.
Let me explain to you the code. And I'll call this, for the purposes of this conversation, guiding principles.
So we really don't have the final say. It's the code, it's the homeowners association.
With regard to style?
Well, whatever you say in that thing, right? Yeah. That size, shape, style, and all that stuff.
No, with regard to style, you don't. But you don't anywhere. In any subdivision.
Well, I understand that. Yeah.
What we will do, this
something conversation.
Yeah, this code will be split up. The covenants, the CCRs, will mandate the things you do not. You don't want to get into the business of governing style anyway. You don't have anybody here who's going to review architecture drawings and say, well, this is not Acadian. You need to put a 12-on-12 pitch to make it Acadian. That's not your role. That's the role of the developer. And the association.
No, but it is our role to give a building permit.
Absolutely.
All right. And if a guy comes in with this something outside of the
outside of the design, and the town of Ruley says, we're not giving you a building permit. Well, why aren't you? Well, because the T&D design says that your house don't look like the others. Well, you, town of Ruley, do you have the authority to do that, or is it the homeowners association? Who has the authority to do that?
If you wanted that authority, you could adopt that authority. I would not recommend you that authority. That would be a slippery slope.
Why would it be any more slippery for us than it would be for the homeowners association?
Who do you employ today on your payroll that does that?
Well, we have one guy that does that, but it would be, if the homeowners association existed and we had the authority, we would say, look, I want you to sign off right here that this house meets what's in that code before we allow you anybody to build in there for you.
Well, the association will. I mean, there's actually, if you look at the document, at the tail end of this, there's a three-part submittal process that they're going to have to subscribe to. The first one is a concept. And essentially, it's,
we do that now. I mean, Ruley Oaks, I mean, it's not that big a stretch to look at the architecture. We do side setbacks, sewage, you know, all the things that you have to meet. The parish does the inspection of the problem. We issue a building permit only after we're comfortable that it meets the codes, whatever we have.
But you add
one more that says that the architecture needs to be by one of these designs. It's not that complicated. You look at the drawing.
Well, let me ask you what constitutes Creole architecture?
Well, whatever the picture you flashed up there is.
Well, I'm only showing bits and pieces of Creole architecture. I'm not showing every possible example. I mean, obviously, I will tell you, listen, from my perspective, I love it when a community says, we're going to make sure we build it just like you're drawing it.
Well, you have to understand, Mr. Hoopnot, and you've heard this before if you've been to Lafayette. You know, I've been mayor for 10 years, and for 9 of those 10 years, we have walked through fire, and we have had, I don't know how many discussions and how many ordinances, all geared to make sure that the community looks like we want it to look. Attis? Put an attis, man. I'm going to tell you, they'll have a parade while you walk down, if you drive down the street. They want you there. Port Allen, everybody else wants the same thing. We have a certain thing we want here because it works.
Right.
And so if the council chooses to approve a T&D, basically what you're taking is a piece of property inside the city limits. You're saying, well, you don't have to follow any of the rules of the town of Ruley. You have these lots and all that. You do what the hell you want. And you got to trust us that we're really going to do the right thing. There's a developer in the room right here who built a very nice subdivision.
That's not what we're saying.
We held his feet to the fire.
That's not what we're saying, though. That's not fair to say that. What we're saying is,
explain to me, if a person gets in there after y'all have all these lots approved that are 40 feet wide, 60 feet wide, whatever, and a guy just says, I ain't building it like this. It's my property. I can do what the hell I want with it.
Okay.
I mean, you know, how do I know that this guy is not going to get away with that?
Right. Well, what I'm telling you is that there are governances that you will adopt. Setbacks, which you refer to, is a mandate. That's not. Now, we will review it as a design review board on the side of the developer. But that's when they submit that plan to you, you're looking at setback. That's what you normally.
They ain't holding a setback. I mean, the thing built on the road and all that.
Huh?
It's no setback to review. I mean, you spilled it right against the side.
No. That's not appropriate. We had setbacks.
Pictures they look like that.
In the village center, there are shallower setbacks.
Okay, whatever.
We have 5 foot sides. We have.
Yeah, I don't get into setbacks.
So that's what you normally
concept,
review.
You know?
You normally review your floodplain elevation,
right?
So they're going to build 6 inches above flood, or what your criteria is. We require 2 feet above that.
Yeah.
Now, you're not going to require they build 2 feet up. You're going to require they build 6. That's your ordinance. That's your requirement. You could if you wanted to, but you don't have to. That's what I'm saying. There are licenses here that we're saying, Creole architecture, if you're saying that you have defined Brule as a Creole architecture place, then we're right on track. Mm-hmm. If you're not doing that anywhere else, why would you want to assume just because you're approving a T&D that you would now get into classical American architecture? You're going to say, look, this handrail, sir, does not have the OG edge that a classical American building has. We're rejecting you. You're not going to get into that. We will, because we have a vested interest, because we've got 4,000 acres of land to create value with. We're not going to cut ourselves short.
Okay.
And I understand where you're coming from there. I want to assure you.
It's a leap of faith.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
I want to assure you that we're governing this development at a higher level than anything you've built in this community.
Okay.
Okay.
The next one says, will civic parts of the development be built pre or post selling a lot?
Before we go ahead, Thomas, I guess just to kind of answer your question, Mayor, in the covenants and the codes, the homeowner association will have that right to go after these people. They will not be able to build. They will not be able to do anything. They will have that right. That right will remain with the developer until he seems fit to turn it over to the homeowner association. But before then, he can stop anything he wants. If it doesn't meet the code, it doesn't meet, you know, what his covenants are. So I want you to feel assured that, yeah, that guy may come in. He may, you know, guy may come and say, hey, I want to put a mobile home out there. Give me the permit. You may issue the permit because you say, okay, well, they doing their own thing over there. I'm going to go ahead and issue him his permit. But at that point, the buck stops with the developer. And at that point, he has all full rights. It will be in everything that the homeowner sees before he buys the lot. It will be within his deed. It'll say in his deed that he's deed restricted by the covenants and by the codes. And that he has to adhere to the architecture committee and also to the homeowners association.
Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with that, how that works for me. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Mr. Thomas.
That's all right. I've seen firsthand the mayor said that, you know, it's a leap of faith, and I strongly agree with him because I've seen firsthand with so-called associations and developers. We're going to make sure that it's built this way. We're going to make sure that it's done this way. You go to Brule Oaks, right across the highway. The town of Brule wanted a certain situation, certain style of houses. Then once the neighborhood started, 20, 25 houses, yeah, they were all following the right code and everything else. But before you knew it, they were building them so fast, there's no way, and the developer was just gone. You couldn't even get in touch with him. Right. He was selling a lot. His houses were being built. Not to the code. The association, what are they going to do? Put a lien on it? Yeah. Half of the people that are doing this, going against what they're supposed to be doing, they don't care if you put a lien on their house. When they sell it, they'll pay their $100 fine. Yeah. So what the mayor said, it's a leap of faith. Absolutely. What you're talking about, it is. Mm-hmm. No matter what you say about we're going to watch this and we're going to do that, yeah, that's, I don't believe it.
You're right. You're right about the leap of faith thing relative to that. I guess the question I would ask you is in Brule Oaks. I'm not familiar. I've driven through there.
And no, it's not just Brule Oaks. It's many, many, many right. neighborhoods throughout all.
What level of governance did they employ? And I happen to know that most of them are CCRs. Mm-hmm. And they're probably
an CCR.
Covenants, restrictions,
yeah,
codes and restrictions.
Yeah.
Typically, they control a very minimal amount of what is being done there.
Well, the problem with that particular situation, I can't tell you the other neighborhoods that are going and going to be astray, but the problem with that neighborhood was that the developer held all control of the neighborhood, would not turn over anything to the neighborhood until every lot was sold, all of this was done, wrapped up, and did what he wanted to do and everything else, and then the neighborhood got control.
Uh-huh. That's not typical. Right. It's 50%.
It's not typical, but that's also a leap of faith. How do I know you're going to do it the right way?
Well, let me say this. I'm going to disagree with you.
They have the codes and documents as well.
What is typical is that the developer maintains control until the very end of the development.
Right. That. You're absolutely
Dane,
right.
Dane, what percentage did you have in years before it turned over to the homeowners association?
90%.
90%. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, why would you invest in a property and then all of a sudden say, well, y'all go and make all the decisions for my future value? You wouldn't do that.
It's one thing, though, I want to make sure I understand. With the developer, Sinclair.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that's enough. There's nothing else to say. I mean, Sinclair surrounds us, and they've done everything to build this community. And I totally trust Sinclair. I mean, you can't put them in the same class.
Nobody's put them in the same class. I'm just saying, I don't want to take a leap of faith with no control whatsoever.
Well, Thomas, actually, I'm hoping that because we develop the level of code we develop, I know that no one's ever developed this level of code. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that the association documents that will be adopted will be in the neighborhood of 180 to 200 sheets of paper. I would put money on it right now, as I stand here, that Brule Oaks does not have that level of delineation. And now that's your comfort level. it's legal. If I buy a lot in there, every buyer now is the person who's responsible to make sure that in the future, things are done according to this document. All right? This is governance documents for the most part. When I talk about street widths, I guarantee you that this is the street. And when we get approval, you're gonna say this is what we're approving. You vary from that. You will answer to us. Same thing is true about setbacks, utilities, all of those things that you normally govern. If you want to govern the architecture, I welcome it.
No, you know, I mean, Butch is standing up. I know Butch. I've talked to Butch about this several times already. You know, we make no bones about it that we want quality development in this area. And the one thing we are scared of, Joey Norman is scared of for sure, is transient buildings. Yeah. Transient being anybody who's renting something and they don't plan to stay and they're moving on. Eventually it gets down and dilapidated and here comes some kind of government assistance building and all that. Yeah. And when you look at, and it doesn't matter what I think, but the citizens of this town believe, you look at a small lot, mm-hmm. and you say there's going to be a small building on that lot because there ain't no room. Eventually that thing's going to look good when it's built, but eventually it's going to turn into something it shouldn't be. We got burned with just a little dinky townhouses right here. We got burned on those. These guys sat up here and said, man, we want you to make those owner-occupied. And they said, oh, no, we don't want to do that. But we trust us. It'll work that way. But one of them has been sold. The rest of them are rented. And every other month we have somebody coming in because they got evicted and all that stuff. They will go down to twos. We're afraid of that. Yeah. You know, and you know, I mean, something has to happen to make us not afraid of it. Yeah. That's just the way it boils down.
Well, that's right. And, you know, Sinclair has been a neighbor and a corporate member here for a long time.
Yeah.
We try to do what's right, you know, just like selling you the oxidation pond, giving you access to it all these years. And we want to do what's right. If y'all haven't been to River Ranch, you need to go and look and see the development that's there. And that is something that we want to create here in Brule. I think we've got a good opportunity, and that's why we hired the best that they have to develop this thing. And it's not nothing that we're just going to throw to and hope somebody comes and rents or buys. It's going to be a planned development. It's being done around the elementary school, which is a very good school, and it's just going to enhance all of that area there. And anything
told,
that we do...
You told me in this council that you would snap your fingers and those places would look like those pictures up there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there'd be any discussion. But that's not what we're worried about. We're worried about there's going to be a bunch of small lots out there.
No,
we're really not going to have any say-so what happens there. And eventually, because of economics, months and years will go by, things are not selling, the economy's not good, enough people don't want to cross the bridge, whatever the reason. And those things sit out there and eventually say, well, you know, we've got to get a return on investment.
That's possible.
We're going to build some
of this stuff. But you know, as a company, we're going to stand behind what we're proposing. I mean, we're not going to do anything that's going to cause that kind of thing. Now, you know, economics might change, like you say, but you don't not approve anything like this because economics might turn bad, and it might go sour, and it might do this or it might do that. Yeah. What we can do now is tell you that we're going to develop the best development that we can for Back Brule. And we've hired the best people we can. They got the best plan, and as far as I'm concerned, smart growth. This is the way to go. You know, these sprawls, these subdivisions and all that you have now, this just makes so much more sense to do. And I think once you start this, I believe it's just going to bloom. It's just going to take off. People are going to want to move.
Now, y'all have done some market studies, and y'all think that may be the one move to Brule, Louisiana. Now, Lafayette, I lived in Lafayette. Lafayette had probably the highest percentage of millionaires of anybody there I know of. I mean, they got people a lot of money over there. You ain't gonna sell many of them to people from Brule. I know that. But you know, you think people gonna come in to live in Back Brule, Louisiana, to fill up this thing?
I mean, you said.
Well, it's your money. It's not my money. It's not my money. You better be surprised. You're not me. I'm not.
Let me answer that question because I think it's important we understand.
Yeah.
I mean, I spent an exorbitant amount of time trying to explain the value of community neighborhoods.
Yeah.
People are people, whether you're in Lafayette, Louisiana. It's not about money, and that's a very important point I want to point out here. It's about creating community and creating value for everyone, including the government. Okay. It's cheaper for a government to manage a community like this than it is continuing to manage more and more suburban sprawl. Your coffers aren't growing. You're not going to have the ability to repair roads that are going nowhere. This is the kind of development that makes economic sense. It makes environmental sense. It makes sense from the market perspective that we're targeting younger buyers, which are not, who are not moving here now. They're moving away from here. We have to give them something they can latch onto. And also, we're not taking care of people who are retiring because we're not building to that segment. We're actually building to a segment that falls somewhere in the middle that doesn't really exist relative to the depth of the market. And so when you say small, I understand your concern. I clearly understand your concern. My hope is that we're able to mitigate that concern by coding it at a level that makes sense. Now, once you adopt this code, you have total control over the basics of that code at whatever level you feel you need control of. That's the answer. If you want to control the landscaping, you have that control. If you want to control the signage, you have that control. If you don't, we will. And that's in our guidelines and that's in our covenants. Okay? And that's important. The quality of the architecture is based on the market. I'm not going to tell you that what we're going to build is going to exceed Brule Oaks. I'm not going to tell you that. I think it will from a design perspective, but the quality of the building, I can't assure you of that. But it will be at least equal to what that is because we can build what we're saying for the same cost as what Brule Oaks is built for.
See, now, I went over this question earlier about how many of this and how many of that.
Yeah.
If you could assure this council that there'd be nothing but owner-occupied buildings in there, I don't think you'd have that much trouble.
I can't do
but if
that.
But if you say, well, we hope that they'll be owner-occupied,
yeah.
But if push comes to shove and they're built out there, we got to rent them, we got to do, because we got to make money. That's where we get in trouble with them. That's where we're concerned. Yeah, that's my concern.
The issue I have being able to commit, I don't control that, but if you had to move tomorrow, or let's say you were in the National Guard and you have to leave tomorrow and go to Baghdad for the next year, are you going to leave your house vacant? Or are you going to rent it?
Well, I mean, I have somebody here, but I was in that situation. I was in the military, and I always took care of it without leaving it vacant or renting it. I wouldn't rent my own personal house, no.
You know why we have an aversion, why I have an aversion to renting? I rented. I used to rent houses myself in Baton Rouge, not here.
I still do.
But you talked about the school system. You know, we know that the school system is the best thing we got going for.
Absolutely.
Period. Yeah. We know that. But we also know when people are transient, they don't participate in civic activities, they don't participate in schools, they don't participate in any of that stuff in general terms.
No, you're right.
But people who live in Brule, you talked about this lady that lived in Algiers.
Yeah.
She said she lived in an environment that was very special. Everybody knew her. Well, that's what we had. We have that already. That's what we're trying to maintain. Somebody said, oh, we're going to increase your population by 1,000 people, man.
You don't want that.
No, we don't want that. I want it to be the last person to move here 28 years ago. And everybody since then wanted to be the last person to move.
We're currently growing.
But we want to try to shape the people that are coming.
But you're currently growing under a model that has proven to lose the connectivity of communities.
Well,
suburban development, people don't even know each other. Because they don't even see each other. They drive in and they leave.
Yeah.
That's suburbia. When you create walkable communities where day in and day out they have a reason to walk somewhere. You can't just say it's walkable because you have sidewalks. That's not walkable. But if I can walk to pick up my mail in the village center, sooner or later I'm going to run into somebody. All right? That's how it happens. I'm going to walk to the school. I'm walking my kids to school. You begin to meet people. You're re-engaging the community. If you continue growing the way you're growing, you will be a big suburban sprawl model for Baton Rouge. That's what's going to happen. You have to begin looking internal to your community and grow it responsibly that way. I'm not saying everything has to be traditional neighborhood development, but you need to be thinking about having those things available to a population that really wants it. And the school's going to drive that. I mean, the diversity in it. The ability to know people. But to answer your question about rental, I mean, obviously I would love to say, yeah, I'll guarantee you that. I can't do that. I mean, I own a house. I didn't guarantee that I would never rent it. I mean, don't think I'll ever rent it. I hope I never have to rent my house. I don't expect to, but...
But it's not the case of somebody renting their house. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a person who's an investor, buys a piece of property, builds a structure on there, and really, really wants to sell it. It's an investment. They want to sell it. I want to sell this. I want to make a profit.
Yeah, they can't sell it.
And they can't sell it. So they say, well, you know, I got a choice. I can keep paying this note. Yeah. Or I can put somebody renting in there until I can sell it. Well, then you really can't sell it then. The same thing happens right here at these townhouses. We've passed orders. We don't allow hotels in this town.
I did not know that.
Multifamily dwellings, I mean, you got to walk through fire to get more approval. Duplexes and all that stuff, I don't see any of those getting approved for a long time, you know?
I'll give you a prime example, I think, of possibly what you're talking about. 2 weeks ago, I called from DEA out of Baton Rouge. They're tracking a call coming from Houston, Texas. He's going right here to the townhouses. Allegedly to drop off 9 kilos of cocaine.
These are beautiful places. And you saw them when they were built. I mean, they were very nice. They were nice. Very, very nice.
But, you know, there's people...
But they got to make money.
But this guy, he's from Baton Rouge. He comes here to rent because it's a nice, quiet place. He doesn't deal dope out of the house. He's below the radar. Just happened to get a tip, but I think that's where he's...
Well, last month, if you wanted to talk about drug issues, at River Ranch, $2 million home was busted.
Absolutely.
An owner didn't rent. Very, very wealthy guy.
Absolutely.
You know, so
we know why you love it now.
Well, no, actually, it wasn't just that. I mean, no. Wealthy for another reason.
But and honestly,
let's try to move on. We've been here now. Let me
finish up with two things, man. Let's wrap this up. One, there's a couple of documents tonight we were talking about. One is the ordinance that we gave to y'all before, and the other one is the code. Okay, you just want to make sure that you realize they're separate. Right, and they're two different things, and they deal with two different things all together.
Yeah, we know.
And just so you got that straight.
I don't think it's fair to developers or architect or anybody else to just pass an ordinance and lead you to believe that the town of Bruley really wants this type of development. We either need to be straight up with you right now rather than wait till a zoning hearing and this room is full of people, everybody's yelling and screaming at each other and all that stuff, you know.
I think we want to answer all your questions. And also, like Mr. Butch said, they've been good corporate partners. They've been good neighbors. We just, you know, we want to come in and see what your feelings are. Is there a middle ground? You know, is there something we can work out or where we stand?
Okay. Let's try to get through these questions.
Question 100.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, man.
I noticed that you had some lots along Ori Drive proposed.
Yes, ma'am.
How many lots was
there? That is actually, there's 20 lots right there in that little section. That's actually 20 lots that fall inside the city limits right now. There's only 3 or 4 of them that actually border Ori on one side, and the rest of them are, you know, they all front either on that extension of Ori we're going to put in or on one of the front streets.
And is it going to be the cottage-type homes, small lots?
They vary. They have cottages on the frontage, and then they get a little bit bigger as you get back toward the neighborhood. And then we did a park. There's a roadway that comes into the project, and there's a park right there.
And that's the only part that's going to be in the town right now.
That's correct.
So if the town doesn't approve a T&D, you're going to go ahead with all the remainder of the proposal, or this depends on the town approving? I mean, well, if you go ahead with the parish part?
We probably would.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, we need to get it approved.
Okay. Yes, sir. I have a question. Have you all considered, I know you put a lot of study, a lot of work into this proposition. Have you all considered the crime rate, what happens? Do you have a number that you can tell me what happens with the crime rate when all of this development is done?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you this. In traditional neighborhoods, period, there's less crime than there is in suburban gated communities. And the reason is, when you begin knowing people in the neighborhood...
I don't want to hear all of that, because I've been there and done that, so...
Have you? Well, then the statistics don't matter then.
Well, sure it matters. Absolutely it matters.
Okay.
My God, what...
Well, you asked me.
I won't even consider.
I was trying to convey the statistics to you. In well-executed traditional neighborhood developments, there is less crime than there is in conventional suburban development. Now, I don't have the specific.
One other question. Okay, a small house.
Yeah.
When a man and his wife buy the house, first thing you know, here comes one kid, two kids, three kids. After a while, there's four kids. Where do they go? Out in the street? Where do they?
No, they step up because it's available in the neighborhood. They can buy a bigger house. They can move. Now, if they anticipate that they're going to build a family, they most likely will not buy a small lot or house. They anticipate the scale of what they're going to do. Obviously, if they plan to have four kids, they're not going to buy an 1100
square foot. Well, we ended up with four, and we didn't plan on four to start with.
But two is so much fun.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. Somebody should have paid more attention to biology class.
One quick thing and that I did notice when I visited River Ranch a few times, at the beginning when River Ranch first started, you had a lot of the younger folks were around the town center, and as you got out, you kind of got to the older group. It kind of has swapped now, and the thing that gets you the most is when you show up at the school in the afternoons, you have all of these grandparents walking down the street to pick up their kids. So you have a lot more interaction inside of the town center and the surrounding neighborhoods itself. I think that answers a couple of your questions. One, you can grow within the T&D. You can either start out small and go to large lots, or also with the crime and stuff, you have your own neighborhood watch. Your people out on the streets, and Jamie will tell you, the more people you have out on the streets, the more people you have out there seeing people you don't know. I called the cops in my neighborhood twice this weekend. You know why? People crossing other yards that I didn't know. I knew that wasn't my neighbor, and I knew that wasn't his neighbor on the other side. Called the cops and said, hey, you need to come find out who these guys are. Cops came over there, questioned them, they didn't belong in our neighborhood, and they got them out of our neighborhood. Same thing. More people you got out on the streets looking and seeing people that they don't know or that they do know, that's a deterrent to crime. But also, too, like I said, I call it the ring of death. I mean, they kind of, you know, you start out in the middle and they kind of grow out to the edges and then it swapped over and went the opposite way.
When we first did River Ranch, the market studies said that if we needed to accommodate the entry-level price point, we used the school teacher salary to do that. We backed in the mortgage and it came out to a 30 by 70 foot lot. We did 12 of them. When we proposed the project, I got all kind of heat from realtors and bankers saying they wouldn't fund them, nor would they be able to sell them. We sold all 12 before the infrastructure was poured. Who bought them? School teachers, firemen, not divorcees, widowers. It was amazing, and we didn't have enough of them. Today, the people who live in those houses were primarily empty nesters. You know, they sold and moved around. But that was the bad news, because what happened was we made an affordable product available to a school teacher. In 3 years, that person was able to sell it at twice the value, and no longer was it affordable. Now, what we're finding, many of the people who built 10,000 square foot houses have sold those, and they've moved into the town center, into condos that are selling for $500,000, and into smaller houses, because they don't want the big product anymore. But they can. They can do that. That product is available. In suburbia, it's one house. You live there, it doesn't fit. You got to move out of there. You're going to go somewhere else. That's the difference. And it creates a value system as a result of that. It's internalized for the most part.
I have another question.
Yes, ma'am.
The people that buy the larger properties, if they want to subdivide it, are they allowed to?
No. Now, you see, that's where we come back to the governance of the city. It is a lot. To create another lot, they got to come to the city. It's out of our control by that point.
Okay. Yeah. It's Riverview. It says Riverview West Baton Rouge Parish.
That's Phillips' project.
It was approved.
Oh yeah,
no, 2007.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That project is ready to go. We've been meeting over the course of the last 3 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that's a field right now.
Yeah.
All right. Will the civic portion of development be built pre or post selling a lot?
It depends on what we say civic
Well, the common areas, what are those things?
The common area will be built, for instance, the town center, the village center, that's first, that'll be built.
I mean, will this be done like a other developments, like all the roads and stuff will be built before any lots will be sold?
Not all of the roads, no. What typically happens is we build what we believe the market can absorb. So we may build...
So it'll be phases?
It'll definitely be phases, because we don't want to build product that has to be rented. The objective is to build it in a somewhat controlled way. Now, there's no one that's going to sit in here and tell you, well, you know, tomorrow the economy's going to go to hell and we won't be able to sell what we did. The goal is to try and do it in a way that does absorb and create place. And we will not do it piecemeal, where there'll be a piece here, a piece here, a piece here. We're going to start at a point and grow it from a central point. It grows from the...
It says how many buildings will be two stories above, mostly above?
The village center is two. All houses are coded to be up to two.
No higher than two?
No.
Okay, that's a, I'm sure the fire department will remember.
Right, well, that was, well, we met with them and that was the reason that was done.
Okay. All right. The next meeting of the town council will be next one. Oh, I'm sorry, one.
You speak all the time about this River Ranch, but we got a bunch of other ones listed here.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about this Acadian Timber.
Acadian Plantation. Acadian Plantation broke ground. They have about a dozen and a half houses. There was a partnership split, and they're kind of in a limbo state right now.
And y'all designed it?
Uh-huh.
Okay. This other one in Lafayette.
That's 3,000 acres, by the way.
In Lafayette.
Sugar Mill Pond.
Caffrey Town.
Caffrey Town was just entitled in August of this year, and we are now working with an assisted living company to expand. There's an assisted living already on that site. We're expanding their cottages into that development.
Right, Sugar Mill Pond.
Sugar Mill Pond is a 2,000-acre project. The first 500 acres is about 40% complete.
Complete built or complete occupied?
Built. Housing,
people
retail, yes. Yes.
Can I ask a question? That's in Youngsville. That's right near Lafayette.
Yeah.
So
they've seen River Ranch and they know what they got.
Yes.
Okay.
It's LSU South Campus.
LSU South Campus was completed a year ago. It is an academic campus.
Everything below that. Is there anything in it?
Well, I don't know what's below
that. Magnolia Square, Riverview, Riverton, Tech Ridge, Pesh Ridge.
I can cover all of it.
Chappapila.
Yeah, Margaret Field in Lake Charles is actually broken ground. There's about 13 houses there. That's about a year old. Magnolia Square is in Central. You can drive through there now. As a matter of fact, they have an event this weekend. They're going to break ground in the town square. There's about probably a dozen and a half houses there. Infrastructure's in on about a third of it. Riverview is your West Baton Rouge
project. They got one house.
Huh? They got one house, yeah, on the river.
And it's actually the city of Port Allen now.
The city, yeah, it is the city. It was incorporated. Matter of fact,
that's right.
Mr. Phillips was at the charrette that we did.
So Phillips woke up one night and said, I want to be a citizen of Port Allen.
Yeah.
Right?
I don't know what he woke up
in. He had the pride. He had his pride in Port Allen.
Riverton, Parish. Yes.
You know, he's a citizen
not
now.
That's what that, but he woke up one night and decided he wanted to be a citizen of Port Allen.
Tesh Ridge is being developed by Southern Mutual Health as an affordable product. They just got their financing a week and a half ago. There was a legal battle amongst the developer and the parent to do a T&D period. They got it approved. It's now underway. Women's Hospital, as you're aware, Women's is building a new facility. They were put on hold because of the bond market. They have recently sold bonds. They're building the hospital. The rest of the stuff will come online now that that's been done. Chappapila is a Hammond project, an 800-acre project we just got entitlement 2 weeks ago. That project is a more rural project, kind of much more rural than the thing we're doing here. And then the Grove is on Perkins Road here in Baton Rouge, right near Perkins Road.
Timetable on this portion, this what you got highlighted to add to do. What is the timetable on this?
On the entire thing that we're showing here, or just our neighborhood for?
Around the school. The little drawing please had right there.
Well, entitlement is the first step. Once we get entitled, if Cletus can develop the civil drawings, it typically is about a 4-month window to get civil drawings done. And then what we will do, and I'll tell you now, is we will gauge this based on market. If the market is soft, we're not going to take off. If the market looks like it's picking up and rates are right and things are doing well, we will begin the project. In theory, and this is all theory right now, if civil is done in 4 months, we got entitlement, the market is correct, within a year and a half to 2 years, you'll have your first phase built out, given the market. River Ranch is 12 years old, 325 acres. We have about 22% left to do, give you a feeling for that. Now, River Ranch was done at a time when the market was soft when we started. It went through the roof, and we did, you know, huge numbers very, very quickly. Settlers Trace here at the Grove, same thing. It started out very, very strong, sold a lot of houses for, you know, a lot per square foot. Market softened. Perkins Road came in. Look what's happened. I mean, that construction shut that project down. It's beginning to pick up now. We're getting ready to do the town center.
So, the biggest thing,
a lot of dynamics.
Work through all the issues.
2 years. The school will help.
Then the next one.
The next phase. Again, that's based on market resources.
You're just putting dots all over the map.
Yeah. Well, first of all, let's talk about additions. Additions as a neighborhood. I don't think we're going to move on another neighborhood until additions is significantly built out. That project will probably be a 20-year plan.
So all of this?
Just additions.
Right,
all of this,
20 years.
None of us will be here.
Right here.
I'm going to be here.
Okay.
I'll be here.
It's 100 years.
Unless something really bad happens.
Now, additions, you'll be here. 20 years is real, given the market.
Yes. This whole field right here.
The 2 year part, once that'll be done in 2 years.
The phase that we submitted to you now.
Let me point to it.
Yeah, let me bring it, both of us to this. Okay.
You got it upside down.
Let's do this because that's how we're referring to it. Here's the school.
Yeah.
Our first phase is this, so that maybe everyone can see. Our first phase is this and roughly that.
Okay.
That's a 2 year play.
Okay. I got you.
All right. That whole neighborhood, I will tell you, based on typical absorptions, 20 years. Okay? Sure. That whole thing you see there, all four neighborhoods, 100 years.
So back to the Molly question, 50 years from now?
Now, I'll tell you this. If the market picked up, this is a suburban play that can happen today because the market's indicating an equestrian validity now. We could do this now. Again, it just depends on what the market's going to do.
But what sell are you on that?
What's that?
What sell are you on building a T&D?
Just a smart growth. Going to meetings and see it and listening and how it's built, the walkability, the community, the town center. I mean, everything is there.
Now, if you have grocery stores and stuff like that, you have to have people that think they can make a profit on a grocery store.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, they're not going to buy a grocery store just to make it in the neighborhood look pretty.
Yeah. You know, the grocery store would be a convenience store primarily. It's not going to be...
I mean, we had Morales here. I mean, it wasn't a pretty store, but it was very successful for 1,000 years. And then all of a sudden Walmart opened up and it just went up. Because the small stores, people go buy a bread, a milk, some cheese, and some eggs. But when they want to go buy a lot of stuff, they go to Walmart.
Yeah, that's
correct. They want to go buy expensive stuff. So they really couldn't make it.
That's correct.
Why would that happen here in a small community like Brule? People go back there to a grocery store when you're only going to have 100 houses or whatever.
Eventually you're going to have 1,200 houses.
Well,
keep that in mind. So the grocer, I'll tell you what typically happens for us. When we do a grocer early in the process, we fund it. It's a losing proposition. But it's a key part to the community. It grows over time. When we did the one in River Ranch, originally we funded it for 3 years. It lost money for 3 years in a row.
Mm-hmm.
Year four, it broke even. Year five was 30% profit. Mm-hmm. And ever since then. Now, husband and wife retired, and it now has reinvented itself. It's not a grocer anymore because we have a bigger grocer right around the corner.
Yeah.
It has become a restaurant for the neighborhood.
Let me ask a question I just passed through my brain, but I hadn't thought about it until now. And I think I know the answer, but I want you to tell me the answer anyway.
Okay.
Council approves this T&D, Bush and him start building it, and everything's okay and all. You know, it's going fine. You know?
Okay.
Some guy comes in, he's got 30 acres of land, and he slaps a plat down and all the lots are 40-foot front. And he says, well, he says, I'm going to build some nice houses on there. Really? That's too small for the town's code. But you did it for Sinclair. You know, you let them build small houses on small lots and all that stuff. What is the answer to that? How can you tell them that you're not being fair to them, or that you are being fair to them? I mean, in other words, is that big old book that Fish had a while ago, one right there, is that the difference? What's the difference? Well,
no, it's not. That's not your tool. Your T&D ordinance is the tool. And in the T&D ordinance that
has been
done, you specify the acreage.
We have a 50-acre minimum, although I will
tell
you...
he has 50. I mean, if he has 50...
You know. Yeah, I will tell you, that's not the key piece to it.
What is the key? That's what I'm really asking. What's the key difference?
Mix of uses.
Yeah.
You have to have a mix of uses. You cannot have a monoculture of just residential. You have to have a multiplicity of lot sizes. You have to have public parks. You have to have streets of varying types. Blocks, alleys... all of those things.
And even though I read this, it's all, it says that in here?
Yes,
ma'am.
So, if you don't have all that, you can't be zoned as a T&D.
That's correct.
Okay.
You can't change the zoning to a T&D if you don't have all of
it. That's right. I'll just make sure.
Why is it as small as 50? I'm going to pick on Butch. I mean, they got 4,000 acres here. They probably got about 15,000 acres total.
Yeah, they do.
And you're going to develop 266 to start.
Yeah.
Where did the 50 number come from?
In the T&D ordinance, it's 50.
Correct. That's what I'm asking.
Oh, why we pick 50?
I think you seem to be the authority on T&Ds in the state.
Well, we helped write that ordinance. Let me tell you what 50 is all about. And I don't believe 50 was a compromise. I don't believe it needs 50. I'll give you an example. Right now, you have at the frontage near the railroad track, you have a commercial strip center right now. If a developer came in and said, I want to build a T&D, the commercial piece already exists. So there's a possibility to create a neighborhood that's walkable by capturing what that little center offers, and the marriage of those two things delivers essentially what the T&D is. It's structured a little differently, but that could work. The reason we did 50 was it seemed to be a good compromise to give you a quality of mixes that had enough meaning to be walkable and mixed use and create a life. That was the reasoning behind it.
Have you ever done one that say, took in a subdivision that was currently there?
Yes.
Like you're talking about this commercial.
Yes, I have. We've done several. I mean, let me tell you something. One thing that suburbia is almost impossible to fix. Once it's built as a suburban community, it's difficult to fix. And by fixing, I mean walkability is critical. You can't create walkability with a driveway every 60 feet. You can't create walkability in houses that are set back 35 feet, with no front porches or no engagement whatsoever. That's not what community is about. When we did the rebuilding of New Orleans, what we did is, because we had an opportunity to redo all of that, we mandated in suburbia that, like in Gentilly, that houses that were 30 feet back would build liners on the front with front porches, and that's what they're doing. That's the code they adopted. That's how we fixed it. It's difficult to go in and take an existing residential community and create a T&D out of it. It's very, very hard. Economically, it probably makes no sense.
Okay. You only exceeded your 5 minutes. We usually get people to talk. Anybody else?
Yeah, I want to
go ahead.
While we got them up here on the hot seat, I just was jotting some notes down while y'all were talking, but it seems like to me, and I certainly understand Butch's perspective, but it seems like to me we're trading off our... Yeah, I should say. Y'all are trying to get as dense as possible without jamming them in there. You showed a slide of what it looked like right after the Depression of a camp where everybody was jammed up there.
Yeah, right.
I guess in super duper theory, the developer would make the most money if he could make lot sizes that big and sell them all at a good, fair price to the person that's going to buy. So, but what we're trying to do is hold on to what Joey said. I think what Joey was saying about we call it R1, residential based community. So we are trying, what you're trying to do is move us off of that to a more denser development. So I got to tell you, I'm really trying to wrap my arms around that. What is a fair number to put houses on. I got to tell you, when we always talk about lot size, we're using it from our side. It's difficult for me to understand this. This whole ordinance, I read it, I got to tell you, I have a lot of confusing items in there. But the part of it that I'm trying to figure out, I think was like what Shane was saying, this thing is, says 50 acres, this is what we're looking at. There's nowhere near that amount of land that we're developing, or y'all are trying to develop in our town. I mean, we just have the little bit around Ori, and back from the school, and there's really nothing in this first phase that encompasses that. Now, part of what we're talking about here is, it sounded like the part that's on the other side of West St. Francis would be if we would annex that. So I may feel different if we had that in there, because now we're talking about adding 1,300 homes to Brule. Right now, if you're asking us to do it right now, we're talking about 20 or 20 lots. Is that what's in that little orange section? Okay, so I may feel a whole lot different if I'm talking about 20 lots than I'm talking about over 1,000 lots. So.
Those are good questions. Let me try, and then you can jump in. Two comments to that. One, the property that is within the city limits today, if you said that you wanted those to be the same size as the commercial or the subdivision lots that are neighboring it, I don't think that would hurt or help us, one way or the other. So we could change those lots to big lots, and it doesn't have any impact at all. I think what you need to be thinking about as a community, which is what I'm hearing you say, you want to be a big lot community. You want to be a single family house community. That's what you're saying. That's suburbia. And if I were to take the HL Law's property today and develop it around your model, then I would just come in here and do whatever the norm here is. I don't know what that is. What, 100 by 150 would be a typical
80
lot.
80 foot minimum frontage, 9,600 square feet.
Okay, so 10,000 square foot lots. To accommodate this population, I would be doing this much land. And eventually, everything that's green will have houses on it. We're not proposing that. What we're proposing is developing neighborhoods. The density at the end of the day will be about the same, 4.5 to 5 units, because while I have to say that this is 10-acre lots, not many subdivisions being developed today with 10-acre lots. When you do a blend of all of this, that's how you control it. You say, we want net development density in our parish to be so many units per acre. Well, we happen to own 4,000 acres. It's not our fault. We're not developing this. Probably 300 acres. There's not going to be a house going in there. We could. The wetland comes through here. We could come in here.
That's 1,700 acres.
Yeah.
1,850 to be more.
There you go. So we could come in here and develop. We're not doing it because we believe this edge to the wetland is a value to the entirety of what we're trying to do as a preserve. So we're offsetting. We're creating a preservation, which by definition is preserved. We do not have the right to develop it. We're designating it that way. But today you don't control this. This is a parish plan, all right? But we're making that statement. We've created what's called a comprehensive master plan. We're creating buffers. And we're showing them that way. I mean, the truth of the matter is, if we do this all today and put all the infrastructure in, you don't have a market to suck this in for another 100 years. So all of this is green. We're not designating this as preserved. We're saying it's a reservation because we don't know yet what it's going to be in the future, because it's way beyond anything we'll know.
That's everything east of the flood.
Right. So I'm trying to answer your question about you want to be what you want to be, and I agree with that. Now, let's take another key issue here. I've got, where am I? Where's my school? Here. I've got 1,200 people here on about half the land that you're going to put your suburban concept on. Do the math on the infrastructure. Half the streets, half the drainage, half the maintenance, half the school runs. Think of the long-term economic gain off of that. That's the reality of compact development. Those are statistics we can provide you if you need those numbers. They're all over the place. Right. It's staggering.
I started this by saying that's what I'm used to. That's, yeah. And I'm trying to understand.
Everyone's used
the T&D guy. Kevin has spent a lot of time with me, giving me some stuff and some information.
Yeah.
This is about third or fourth time I've heard you speak, and every time I think I pick up a little bit more. But I got to tell you, the concept is just...
Yeah, it's hard to put your arms around. Yeah.
To say the least. Now, I've read a lot of stuff on the internet. I want to talk about traffic. I also heard you say back at the school back there, a lady asked you a question about traffic, and you very pointedly told her, ma'am, you already have a traffic problem.
Yeah. They do.
Okay. I understand that. Because if I've ever said anything up here that I know, I'm in that traffic every day from Sherwood Forest and back.
Yeah.
So, but your comment was, we didn't create the problem.
Right. We'll
therefore, we can only try to help solve it.
Right.
So, and you mentioned one avenue, but also I got to look at these people out here.
Right.
If I'm talking, we're 20 years or 5 years or 2 years or whatever, the market's got to get better than it is now.
It will.
If we had 1,000 homes here,
you're going
to see some road rage.
Yeah.
Okay? So the traffic is still a main issue. I think a T&D creates more traffic than it saves. I understand you got streets, you don't have streets that you have driveways on, but everybody's pulling behind there. My question is, if you've got a Christmas party and you got 20 people, where do those people park?
On the street. Just as they would. Nobody can park.
Okay,
you have 20 people at your house today, where are they
18 foot wide.
I'm sorry?
Your street, you said, was 18 foot
no,
wide.
No, we don't have any 18 foot wide streets in here. In T&Ds, we can do 18. We have none of those. You can look at those sections. We have, our streets are 24 feet in width. And I think, actually, that's not unusual for you now. So we do have, that's the narrowest street. We do have, no, that's not true. I have a one-way street that's 18 feet wide, but it's one way, and it's around the entry where that ditch is. That's the only one we have. But typically, they're 24 feet.
Okay.
But let me just so that I can talk about the traffic issue. Again, you would rather grow big lots, but you're still going to end up with the same number of people. Okay, at the end of the day, there's going to be a market for X number of people, so the same traffic is going to be there. But if you grow it in a suburban way, you're loading up the main collectors, which is where your problem is, because everybody's coming out right there, and then they load that collector. You're going to have a problem no matter what we do, because you have one way out, and that's over that bridge, the railroad track, right? Well, you have two, right? But you have one crossing today. And so we have to begin thinking about how we're going to deal long-term with traffic, and the grid is how you do it. And so during the school board meeting, what we proposed and showed them, here's our development today. We're proposing, this road is already here, all the way to here. It's already in. We're proposing connecting and bringing it out to here and having another connector here. And during the charrette, it was pointed out to us that there's a new bridge being built over here. We want to continue, this is comprehensive planning, and Kevin is very much a part of this. You need to be thinking about bringing this road all the way back. Because the bottleneck isn't just here, it's here as well. And so we're trying to now think of, we're not opposed to putting a grid here. And so now you have another north-south component besides LA1. I think that's what I was trying to explain to the lady at that meeting. I acknowledge the problem, it exists today. The other theory, and I will tell you it's a theory, and it probably will not generate a whole lot of value until this is built, is that when people can begin doing things in one area without having to leave, I don't have to go to the grocery store. Yeah, I do have to pay 20 cents more for a gallon of milk, but when gas is $5, that's cheap. And I can walk to get milk, I'm not driving. My kids can walk to school, I'm not driving. My wife can go to work at the insurance agency, or I can work down here. That's what begins to happen. And those things actually do occur because, and the more conducive it is because of traffic, the more often it happens. So that's the theory. In suburbia, you don't even have that option. So let's follow your tract. You're going to put 1,800 houses here over the next 20 years. They all leave. They all have to go to work, and they all have to come back, and they all have to go get a loaf of bread, and they all have to bring their kids to school. You want to talk about traffic congestion, and there's no grid.
Okay. Garbage trucks,
yep.
School buses, still
yes.
I have to go through that. I hear you talk about walking to school, but that's an
elementary
school.
Yeah, not everybody walks to school.
And that's a pre-K through
yep.
three school.
Yep.
there's not going to be many kids walking.
Well, we hope to make it pre-K 5 over time. I think that's what's going to end up happening. It may or may not.
Yeah.
Most of them still wouldn't walk.
But still, you got garbage trucks.
Yeah, at the end of the day, we have to run all of those things through here, and we have to do the engineering to do it.
Okay.
So I mean, we can't say a bus, you can't come through here. I mean, it has to work. And they run through all the T&Ds now. Now, there's some, you know, there's some design things we do that, but all of that's done. Fire truck, big one. That has to go through here.
The setbacks.
Yeah.
Joey had started to talk about setbacks. I thought he was going to ask what I wanted. Some of your pictures showed the units with like zero lot lines touching each other.
In the town center.
That's the town center only?
Yeah.
Okay. In the cottage homes and that, this one says 5 foot.
7.5 or
five. This says 5 foot. That's 5 foot. This one and this one. So it's 10 foot behind, but
side to side
from each building?
Yeah. Each building. Okay. And that's what you have in your subdivisions today. 5 foot minimum. They could be more.
10.
No, we have 10 foot there.
Oh, you have 10 side
yards? Each side is 10.
10.
20, really.
Okay. Yeah, we have 5. That's code. I mean, that's building code.
And that's what River Ranch has, the same?
River Ranch has 0 on one side. You can do 0. We don't have that here, but at River Ranch, you can do 0.
On one side.
For a cottage. For a cottage, you have 0 on one side. The theory there was, and is, we didn't do it here, but is that the 5 feet that you typically allocate to your side of your house is dead land. What do you do with it? Compressors, lawnmower storage, firewood storage. What we said was if you took the 10, move the house to the 0 lot line, and you consolidate the land on one side, and 10 is minimum, you can do as much as you want. You have a side yard living space that's, you're taking all of this land and consolidating it. So a smaller lot has more value. And actually, believe it or not, those are selling for $28 a square foot now.
So at that point, what do you do with your lawnmowers, firewood, and everything else?
You can still store them in there, but you have more place to do it.
You can only put it on one side of the house. You can't put it on the other.
Let me answer the one more thing.
How about fire concerns? You know, that's the reason we have a 10-foot side setback.
The International Building Code was adopted since River Ranch has come out. And in truth, now, a 0 lot line home has to have a 1 hour rated wall. So we don't code that anymore. That's why this has 5 and 5. The International Building Code allows 5 feet. You have to have 10 foot of separation. So that's what that's about. Yeah, 10 foot gives you no fire value. I mean, yeah, it probably does, but it doesn't from an insurance perspective. The fire code is what's going to rule on that, and we meet the fire code, International Building Code.
Okay. Anybody else?
And y'all have already talked to the school board about donating some property at the elementary site, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And it would be sufficient enough property to make that school?
It would be, but they haven't made a decision to do
right.
I just want to make sure. We talked to them about it, we put it out there and said, you know, we'd like you to consider this. These are some options we're looking at. We preserved it, or reserved a section for them if they would go that route, so that's available.
And if that's a pure donation, that's not a sale.
I said, well, I'll let Butch answer that.
We hadn't got that far yet.
Okay. But there has been talk about
that. Oh, yeah. Okay. That and the high school also.
Okay. On the north side towards your office?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
We actually
talked about that a long time ago.
Yeah, they've been talking, and we're talking to the school board, and we're not sure if it's going to be a donation or not.
Right. You know,
depends on the talks and how that proceeds.
This is the land that's been designated for the high school, so you get a sense. Here's LA1 Sinclair. I mean, the plantation here, the old home site. So this is the high school site.
Okay. So the portal there for the high school is going to be a T&D there, too?
All of these are T&Ds.
Well, I mean, the one by the high, that's going to
yes.
be... When's that? Is that going to go?
Again, that's all
behind. Ahead or behind this one?
Probably, well, definitely behind. There's not enough market to do any more than this right now.
Well.
Why'd you choose that one?
Yeah, that's
school.
Why?
Elementary school.
Oh, because of school.
Elementary school.
High school doesn't count. I mean,
high school would be analogous to another industry.
And then you have the park. In the back, too. You know, that's another draw.
Okay. All right, anybody else? Just you, Dylan. I don't want to rush you. No, I'm serious. I don't
understand. I mean, this is one of the biggest things we've
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ever had to deal with.
Yep.
Probably the.
All right, well.
I'd like to offer, if any of you are interested in visiting River Ranch, I'd be glad to take you through and we can explain the code real time, if you're interested.
This list you have of these others, I will be calling a few of those.
Absolutely.
Just back, many of us I can find. This thing you have here, this big old thing there, what is that thing called?
Guiding principles.
Guiding principles. Could you let me, leave it with me a day or two or whatever so I can read? I know you're only going to have another copy of it.
Yeah, I'll leave that with you and let you go through it.
If y'all need it, I can do it another time. It doesn't have to be.
No, we want to visit the, can we go as a group or we have to have a special meeting?
Hey, you can only go with two council members at a time. Then we wouldn't want to have any hanky-panky going on, you know, with our ethics law.
I'm against the hanky-panky, by the way.
Yeah, I'm against it too.
But can we, you want, you going to keep this for you?
Not for me, no, for all of us, you know, but I definitely want to go through it myself.
We appreciate you going through it.
Well, I don't know.
I'm sorry?
Fitz, you can have it tomorrow, I mean. Whatever.
I've got to tell you, I'm not exactly the fastest reader. I'm going to need a little while to go over this.
Yeah. Tell me when you need it, I'll do it as I need.
I'm fine. I don't know if people realize just how big a need we have. The small housing for older people. The street I live on, everybody's dying off. We're the old part of town. And there's big lots, big houses, one person. And we desperately need that.
Yes, absolutely.
Gladys, I'm going to tell you something. I'm 63, right? I live in Baton Rouge, got a 1 acre lot. There's going to come a time, and it won't be long, before my wife is not going to want to, she's already talking about wanting to move. I don't want to mow that grass or stuff. If these guys told me that this thing was going to be built out the way those pictures show, and that there was going to be people like retirees and people of you know, who have a good income salary, and they were going to live there, I would stand from the top of the highest mountain and say this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. That all comes down to that one concern about whether or not we change in the way we do business really from a single family residential to a transient life with small lots and small houses that you have to trust is going to be like that 10, 15, and 20 years from now. When I'm 10 years from now, I'll be 73, so I probably won't really care.
It's going to happen whether we're in office or not.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. You know, I mean, there's four or five little squares down there, and the one it really is the one that we wanted to first. You know,
well,
I mean, it's a leap of faith. There ain't no question about it. I mean, you either got to believe it's going to be nice, or you don't believe it's going to be nice. Dane came in here years ago, and he sat down and he took all kind of abuse from the public. He said, I'm going to build a nice subdivision with nice houses. He had the designs all drawn up and all that stuff. And I'd say, 75% of the crowd did not have faith. But it turned out to be exactly like he said it would. All the houses in there are very nice, very, very nice place to live. You know, but it was a leap of faith. But it was to our codes that we had at that time. He 8 foot front and all that stuff. You know, and you know, Butch is a personal friend of mine. He's family almost, because his sister is married to my brother-in-law.
Butch, you never got
to help me. But I've given him more crap than anybody. You know, I said, why in the hell would you want to not build another thing just like Brule Oaks? It sold out so fast, we couldn't write building permits fast enough. So why in the hell would you do that? I mean, you got land ain't a problem. You know, you got dry land.
Right.
So I'm having a difficult time because it's so much of a change the way we do business. It's just so much of a change. I mean, we fought up here like all kinds of things to make sure we can get rid of the kind of development we want. And look, Addis is over there, man. They're ready for you. Anything you want to build, they'll build it. Look, Kevin back. He's smiling, man. He wants all that development. In little old Brule, here we are. That we have, a quarter mile wide, and you want to build it here. You want to experiment here. That's the hard part.
We're not experimenting here.
Well, oh yeah, it's an experiment. Oh yeah, everything you do like
this. Every neighborhood is an experiment.
Everything was an experiment.
Well, then, so that we're just suburbia, we would be experimenting as well. I guess that's the.
It was an experiment when people moved out of the cities and went out into suburbs and built these subdivisions we got now. Everything's an experiment. But anyway, the process is, the bottom line is, we have a regular meeting in the town next Monday. And the first step is somebody needs to introduce it. Any one of council members can introduce it. After that, it gets advertised. It comes back for a public hearing the following month at the second Monday. It'll have a public hearing. It'll get voted on.
Advertising.
It's zoning ordinance.
Oh, that's right. We got that onerous. Yeah,
you got all those extra advertisements because it's got to go before the planning and zoning commission. It's got to be
27
three times before them, and it's got to be advertised. So if you introduce it next month, it would be.
It would be March.
It would be the end of February before the Planning and Zoning Commission could consider it, and it would be March, the second meeting in March, whatever that is.
Well, and it depends on also to Mr. Tom if it's because some people see it differently, and some people with the council. If you can run the advertisements consecutively, in other words, like while you're advertising for the planning commission,
you can start doing it
for the council.
No, you can do that.
Okay.
Some
people do have a problem. They say they want the planning commission approved first, and then they'll start the advertisement for the council.
Well, I mean, but
it's up to you.
The last two times it's up to the council.
It just makes a one meeting.
What timeline they are.
But I think we did the dates this morning.
Anyway, the point is that what I said wasn't going to happen. It ain't going to happen next month. But anyway, first step in the process is somebody's going to introduce, and then that's at any meeting that any council member can do that.
The earliest would be March. Put it that way.
That's
y'all know all that stuff. But we appreciate y'all staying within the five minute time limit that we have.
Anytime, nice y'all.
Clock says 9:00.
Please see it move.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
And I'm hanging around afterwards and stuff. And look, also too, just in short, if y'all want to go visit, you want to go one, two at a time.
We can only go two at a time.
Right, I'm available to go. You can ride with me. I can take you. We can sit with Steve. We can have lunch on him down there and stuff.
Wait a minute, whoa, we got limits on that.
We go to the ice cream stand and get a
football ticket. If you get your own five football tickets, we're not going to talk to you.
BYOB.
Now, Kenny and somebody played next Friday. Can you get those football tickets?
So just, if y'all want to, give me a call. You can set that up. I can get you with the right people down there. He has a really good guy that can tour you and give you a lot of information.
Well, I've been there before. It looks like Disney.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
Well, you need to let me know. You need to go to YouTube and see what
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you guys for having us.
Wait a minute! You come to a meeting every month, twice, and I'm.
I think that's
mayor.
I think that's been more steady than anybody we've seen.
All right, thank you. Let's try to move on. Top three derelict buildings, that'd be pretty easy. At 408 Gwynn Street, Ms. Martin told me that they were going to have a court hearing in December. I have to check on that tomorrow and make sure that it did when it really happened. 626 Main Street, they've made a lot of progress. The outside looks good. I mean, I know they're working on the inside because I see, like laboratories and stuff on the ground, so they must be doing something inside. 229 St. John is Shirley Brown. Live Oak. 3658 Live Oak. That person has a building permit that runs out at the end of December, and if he has not finished his building, he will be my next candidate for derelict building, in which case we'll start the paperwork and all that. And that's all I have for that. And the Farou House on East Main, the chimney's down. It's a clean piece of property except for that one little tool shed. What is it?
The garage.
Yeah, the garage, and we're going to inspect that one in due time. So that's going to go off the list, I'm sure. It'll be done by next time. Any questions on that? Questions? Comments? All right, next is Finance Committee, review the November bills. Turn your back.
Straight and arrow. Straight and arrow.
Just restriping West St. Francis Street.
Okay. University of Phoenix.
That's some kind of police class.
That's
Southam.
Tom Southam going to college for criminal justice.
Yeah, he answered this question.
What classes is that, James? Say again.
He's going to the University of Phoenix, working on his degree in criminal justice. That's the only way that I will reimburse or help pay for schooling is if it's in a police-oriented field.
We got that in the budget?
Yeah, we've done it before. We had Charlie was going to college. He was going to PRCC, and Jeremy was at one time.
Probably the train.
Anybody else?
I got to ask the 220,000 red ton. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, street overlay. Yeah, and the 2,500.
Change order.
Change orders one by order.
2,500?
Yep. Well, for your information, I sent him a, did I send it? Yeah, I sent him a picture. We had Curtis and him go down River Oaks, distance of about 1,000 feet, and they picked up one front end loader full of gravel and garbage shrapnel that had been thrown in people's yards. After they said they had gone down, is it the one that Ed Paul Blanchard lives on? Is that River Oaks? Right. Right by the
Black Oaks?
Right, Skipper has his lot, you know, in the corner. The dead pecan tree that's like yielding tons of pecans this year. You remember that tree?
Across the street from Ms. Jones, Black.
Yeah, down that street. Well, they had so much stuff in the yard, they went out there. They said they went out there 3 or 4 times, but we know they went out there twice. And after that, I just gave up. I said, go out there. And I told Wayne and them, they walked down the street and they picked up, you know, a front end loader bucket full of asphalt and limestone rock and all kinds of stuff. So I took a picture of it. I attached it to the check when I mailed it to Red Tom.
Why would you just go to Red Tom and get it back?
Red Tom subbed out the entire project to Coastal, and Coastal was the one that had trouble with it. I'm just glad it's over with, that's all. So I'm just very glad to be gone. There's a whole lot of problems. But anyway,
okay.
What else is something?
Energy for $6,000.
That's for straight lines and utilities and combination.
We don't pay that. How often we pay that much?
Where are we at on them updating, fixing these lights? I know we go ride often and look at the same group lights.
We only have about 3 or 4 of them. Down almost nothing.
Okay.
They're doing good. Pretty good. Anybody else?
These are charges. Ready? So that's by video camera for school resource officer.
Yeah, that's a video camera for Travis Anderson at the middle school, a flip-it camera it's called. He uses it, there's a bunch of thefts going on, and it actually takes standard pictures too. He requested it, and we had some money in the budget. So,
I mean, is that a handheld?
It's a handheld. It's
got a little
big as a phone jack.
Yeah, it's about as big as a phone. One of the teachers at the middle school had one who actually used it to catch some kids stealing some stuff. So Travis asked if he could have one because they have no kind of video surveillance at the middle school.
Well, I guess that's what I'm trying to ask you. You're saying, is it video surveillance or does he carry it with him and he tries to take pictures?
You can do either or with it. He's done both with it.
You can set it up and tell it to record for 1 hour on top of a locker or something. It'll record for 1 hour and shut off. It's timers on it and everything.
Either that or you can carry it and take actual video or still photos with it.
Okay. So that's That's tagged with Brule police numbers and everything?
Yes, sir, it's on our property.
Okay.
Yeah, our property is required at $500 or more, but anything electronic like that, I put in our inventory list.
I guess we'll, I want to take the, I'm going to call it Skechers, $160, Banana Republic, $232, and Academy Sports, I'll call it $300, all clothing stuff.
The Banana Republic and Skechers, that's not the expensive store, that's at the Albert Mall. Ned and I both went and got dress clothes, slacks, dress shirts, and dress shoes for meetings and stuff like that. I hadn't bought any dress clothes in quite a few years. The Academy Sports, Ned went and bought insulated underwear for all of the guys for the winter season.
Do we normally buy that stuff?
Yes, sir, we had. We've done it previously.
I guess I just didn't remember, just don't remember that. And all that's included in supplies, police?
Mm-hmm. Because uniforms and all of that is combined into one line item now.
Okay. What kind of dress clothes is that, Jamie? I mean, just like slacks and civilian?
Slacks and button-up shirts for court, and we can put the logos on the shirts and stuff like that.
I just don't understand the reason why the people's tax dollars is paying for dress clothes. I mean, if it was a police officer type uniform, stuff like that, I can kind of understand that, you know, that's your uniforms and all, but just regular dress clothes and stuff. Anyway.
I'm done.
Anybody else? Okay, liquor license approval. That's a list of elbows and pads dropped off, but we'll put those on the next time. That's all we have. We don't have any. That used to be a big deal in town, liquor license, but we don't change for many years.
Right.
Not a big deal. Personnel holiday schedule for January 2011. Did you say today, Debbie, something's missing from it? Not missing, but
January 1st.
Oh, January 1st is not on there.
Usually, if all of a Saturday, we'll take the Friday.
Okay.
And it's in 2010.
So we didn't have to list it this year, since next year it's going to be. Oh, we did list it.
2011 is going to be.
Are we going to take it that Monday? That's what y'all going to do.
So you're saying it'll be in 2012 next year is when we're going to be taking the vacation?
No,
for two.
So.
All right, I'm mixed up. Explain to it again. I'm
right, honest. It's on a Saturday, so December will be in. Friday in 2010.
If you take the Friday, it's December 31st, right. 2010, so it's not in 2011.
Oh, that's right. We already took care of that a couple weeks ago, a couple months ago, didn't we?
We talked about it,
but
you wanted to let the council
know about. Yeah, that's right. They're going to borrow a day at the end of this year. We didn't look far enough ahead last year to approve the Friday before January 1st as a holiday. So it's not really, they're not really supposed to have a holiday that day, but we're going to borrow it and not give them one next year. Trade it.
No, our 2010, everything that was approved, we had from January, all New Year's, all the way to Christmas. But we stopped at Christmas. The way New Year's falls for 2011, that would be on our 2010.
We have two New Year's holidays in 2010 and none in 2011. Is that right?
So you can take an extra one at the end of the year and you're not going to get
we should have approved two New Year's Day holidays.
Why don't we just amend the 2010 holiday schedule?
Well, I thought we did a couple of months ago. We didn't? Well, let's do
next
that
week next week.
Time. Yeah, just amend it.
Okay,
put it, amend the 2010.
Okay.
And then 2011 is still going to stay like this.
Right.
Nothing. Okay, that's fine.
Right.
All right.
We take an hour at the plant preceding the holiday.
That's the best thing to do, just make it official. Do it right.
It runs concurrent on time sheets, so it's not like it's a
recreation, I don't know anything. Police top three nuisances, Jamie?
After the last council meeting, myself and the Lance Mayor rode around and picked out the three worst spots. And kind of started over with this again. 752 West Main started out with three vehicles there that needed to be removed. We have two of them are gone. We got one we're still waiting on to move, so they made some progress. The next one shows two addresses. It's kind of the same property, but not. I didn't want to separate them, but total between the two, they had five cars. Three of them are gone. We got two left for them to move. 309 Vaughn, which is right up here, had four cars. Two of them had been removed. One, a son has to come get, and the other is sitting there pending some insurance litigation. He wants to leave it right where the wrecker dropped it.
Photos?
I asked if he could push it 10 foot behind the fence. We dealt with one like that before. It took quite a while on the move. So. But we made some progress out of 9, 10, 11, 12. We got rid of 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So.
Anybody have any comments? Government affairs, nothing. Other matters, nothing. Nowhere. Mayor's report already talked about the trees along the... talked about trees on the same fence that been planted. We had the Vets Day program. It went well. I attended a Thanksgiving meal at Brule High School. It was tough, but somebody had to do it. We got the Chamber of Commerce Resource Guide. If anybody wants to look at it, they send us a copy every year. I taught four civics classes at Brule High like I do every year. And I add on that what it means to get a ticket in Brule, and they always want us to know that than anything else. And I attended a ribbon cutting at Lake After Hours. And with that, remarks of personal privilege. Anyone? Yes, sir.
The mayor forgot to tell y'all, the town did get full payment on one of our nuisance liens that we found.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, when the sheriff said, that guy's been doing some work. Been bought that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rocking and rolling, cutting trees, fixing the porch. I'm glad because that old house.
Right. So, as I said in an email that I sent to the councilman, that's the first time that ordinance has been going all the way through, including the lien and getting the money back. It's the first time we made it all the way through. So, he did get our money back.
I thought that was him on the tractor the other day.
Anybody else? Y'all don't want to stay a little longer?
No, sir.
Announcements: the town hall will be closed December 23rd, 24th, and planning and zoning meeting will be December 15th with a lot of stuff on the agenda. Do you hear a motion to adjourn? Move by Mr.
Second.
Mr. All the favors say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Aye, have it. 9:07.